720 WGN. Hi, atop Chicagoland and the Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Daniel here with you until 5 a.m. In for Nick DiGilio. And, you know, over the course of this week, we've done a bunch of things. You know, whether we're talking like the holiday movies, the Christmas movies that were out there, we did a little bit of that, more like a lot of that. We went through the top 50 of them. It was an amazing ride through celebratory, you know, festive cinematic experiences. And we talked yesterday, last night, a lot about tailgating, barbecues, prepare for what could be an inevitable Bears Super Bowl run. And tonight, excited. This is one of the benefits of this time slot, as so many of the people that we would normally, you know, either have in the show, on the show, or talk to in the local area or even in America really are asleep. So we get to do sort of a spin the globe, right? And we're going to have sort of a world tour for travel and the taste buds today. And we are going to go all over the world. We're going to go to Cairo, Egypt. We're going to go to Rwanda. We're going to go to Australia. We're going to talk a little Scotland. We are going to maybe hit the beaches of Aruba. We're going to do all that with our sidekick, who is riding shotgun with us today, one of the absolute very best in the business, the dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine, a guy I have traveled with, so I can verify he knows his stuff. And certainly if you follow his social media, you'll see him in traditional garb of the locals from many exotic and maybe not so exotic, but always cool places. The one and only Dave Hammond in studio.
Hey, Dave. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. And so these are, and for those people out there, Dave does a lot of writing for a number of different publications, certainly right here with our Tribune, and over the years, so many different things. Done a fair amount of radio for WBEZ. You've heard him do some things, and Rivet Radio and some other incarnations, usually with sort of that travel and certainly that food kind of interest there. And so, but you don't get to do it all the time, Dave. So this is going to be an interesting kind of fun ride for you to take some of the things that you do, share those experiences, and get some feedback from the listeners.
With a kind of a focus on food, and I think a lot of travelers these days are looking for food when they travel. They don't want to have just what they're having at home. They want to try the local stuff, which I think is cool. I think American diners are more sophisticated now than they've ever been before.
I wonder if it was always that way.
No.
And I think over the last maybe at least 10, 15 years that I've been doing a lot of the food stuff, syndicated radio, and I think we've had sort of this renaissance, if you will, of people who like food, love food, are interested in food. Everybody's, you know, got to have some sort of relationship with food to survive,
and
right?
The stereotype of the American traveler is they get to a foreign country and say, hey, where's the McDonald's?
Where's the Pizza Hut?
Right? I don't think that's so true anymore. I think that Americans, I mean, even in Chicago alone, can try so many different types of cuisine. And they want to try different stuff. And they find that when they do try new and exciting foods, that they like it.
And people are so, I think, engaged into their travel experiences like they never were maybe in the past. Where through the internet and through social media, you can see what great things are happening in restaurants or in cultures all around the world immediately. And you can say, hey, if I get a chance to go there, I want to not only go there and try maybe that certain type of cuisine, but also get in, maybe go to that restaurant, maybe meet that chef and do those things. And these are the things that weren't, that just wasn't possible a long time ago. I mean, Dave, you'll know as a travel guy, you know, it wasn't that long ago, maybe 15 years ago, that you just depended on maybe a brochure and a travel agent. Mm-hmm. And she told you.
Or the concierge, not necessarily the best guide. No, I'm no kidding. No kidding. I mean, some concierges actually get kickbacks from restaurants where they send people. Is that a secret? Not anymore.
I don't know that it is, you know, and maybe that's just the way, you know, the enterprising, you know, restaurants or people out there.
Enterprising concierge.
And the enterprising
make a little extra cash.
Concierge, right? I'm sure that the big concierge lobby is going to be defending that and saying, hey, that they still, I'm sure, have a conscience.
Many honest concierges out there.
I'm sure, right? Because the last thing they want is people coming back and say, hey, the McDonald's just wasn't all that.
That Big Mac was terrible.
The secret sauce here in Shanghai just,
you know, I'd like to say just a word of thanks to the late Anthony Bourdain for, I think, teaching us all that it's cool to go to other countries and try food that you've never had before and just take the plunge, take a sample of that stuff, and just see if you dig it. Because I think the likelihood is high, if they're eating a lot of it in that country, it's probably pretty good.
If you've got a culture with hundreds of millions of people at the very least, some billions, right? And if it's great and popular, hey, we're all human beings. There's got to be, you know, some things going right there. I think it is true. I think when you think about Bourdain, we can all say, like, hey, maybe there's been a romantic attachment with French cuisine for a long time and sure, the idea to go there and eat and enjoy. But what Bourdain did do is he made average, everyday street food. Number one, demystified it, right? Because he would sit there with people that were local that talked about that history, their connection to it. And then he tried it and was able to share with that background, like his love for it, just average stuff.
And show the people behind it, too. And I think that makes viewers more likely to try that food when they see mom and pop sitting around the table making it for Anthony, and they're all loving it.
So, and he has been almost from the Philippines. He's been there, all sorts of different places. You could, again, spin the globe and find someplace. And oftentimes he would head to places that were well off the beaten path, right? That these were not even places that were maybe thought of as food. I'm doing the air quotes destinations, you know, he would get, but obviously that is the, and I've thought this and said it a ton over the years, is that I think food is, and you've seen it and experienced it, is the great connector, right? It is one of the things, whether it's, you know, music and art, and we've got a few of them out there in the world, but that really, you know, connects people regardless of whatever kind of cultural differences, or even, you know, whether it's political differences or whatever kind of problems people may have, that we can get together over food.
We all eat. We all eat. And it's fun. I think Americans are now ready to try different foods because they find that, what do you know, they taste good.
So we're going to kind of take that that world tour, a little bit of travel, and certainly some for the taste buds. We're going to go places like, well, we're going to have Blake Stubbs is going to come out and talk about some of the movies. And that has been sort of, yeah, before the coming of Anthony Bourdain, that was some of the inspiration where people would see things in movies and say, you know what, I want to get out and I want to go there. And some of that influence of Blake Stubbs, blockbuster Blake Stubbs, is going to share some of those titles. And we'll talk about some of the movies that maybe launched some of those ships on the travel and visitor side. And 2 a.m., a good friend, longtime guy. This is you want street cred on the food side, and also a very nice place to talk. Although, you know, Dave, we can't complain. It's like 50 degrees outside, so
it's hard to think, gee, I really would like to get away from Chicago in the winter. It's springtime.
It feels
it's sick. We're going to pay for it somehow, I know.
The beaches of Hawaii and Kona, Chef Sam Choi is going to be talking to us a little bit after, too. We're going to talk about the poke movement, which is alive and well here in Chicago. Breadfruit, I guess there's some stuff going on with that. He's going to fill us in on that. We'll talk about some street. We're going to talk about some travel to Hawaii. Not that anybody is a stranger to the desire to head to Hawaii, but he'll give us a little bit of insight into that. And on the street cred side for the food, Sam Choi is a guy that beat Morimoto in Iron Chef when it was in Japan. Like, he went over there and beat them, so he'll be joining us from Hawaii. That will be, I think, a lot of fun. And then 2:30, we're going to talk with, it's Greg from Rwanda. It sounds like a caller. Larry from Berwyn, hello.
Greg from Rwanda.
But Greg, now you know him, and he's...
I do.
And that is, when you think about a place like Rwanda, certainly, you know, the stories in the media and the news and the mystery in general of Africa, but he's doing a lot of stuff there.
He makes the best banana beer I had in Rwanda.
That's high
praise. Sounds like a joke. I tried it at a bunch of different places. I mean, they sell it at convenience stores, never in restaurants. It's always like a quick service thing. I tried his, and it was light years ahead of the other ones I had.
Now, banana beer, and we can talk about the merits.
You sound so a little dubious.
I did an entire segment this fall about, you know, the problems with the whole pumpkin spice thing, you know, and how...
Oh, definitely.
How it's, yeah, I don't know, some, it's either a sign of the apocalypse or some kind of, like, evil bane.
To quote Saint Bourdain, pumpkin spice should die in a pool of its own blood.
So when you think about the banana beer, it's something that, I guess if you got a lot of bananas and you like beer,
and they do in Rwanda,
and you like beer, and who doesn't, you know, what are you going to do, I guess?
We can talk about, let's talk about this. Actually, though, as a side note, I talked to the guys at Pipeworks in Chicago, a brewery. They're going to whip up a bunch of Greg's banana beer this spring. So that's kind of a cool thing. It may be the first time banana beer has ever made it to Chicago.
Look at this. This is, I don't know if you call it some kind of an ambassador, but here you are, right? You're bringing people together over banana beer. That can't be wrong.
We'll have a sip and make a decision. Right. No, I honestly liked it. Although, if you go into banana beer looking for, like, beer-like taste, you're going to be disappointed.
So what is it? Is it like...
It's fermented banana juice. I mean, okay. You can ferment, you know, anything with sugar or starch in it. So... As long, you know, they don't distill it. It's just fermented. It sits around for a couple of days. Boom. Beer.
And banana is one of those flavors out there. Over the years, I've had some, you know, food scientists come in where it is one of the unique ones that you have a banana and it's in its normal fruit-based state. It tastes one way. But then the recognized and accepted banana flavor, like banana flavored gum, tastes nothing like...
If you have it in circus peanuts.
it's like grape, you know, bubble gum or something. Doesn't taste like an actual...
But here's the thing. Banana beer doesn't taste that much like banana, actually.
Or beer? What is it?
Well, Greg told me
it tastes like rutabagas, Dane. I don't know why.
Or coconut. No, it was quite good. It's not aggressive. It's low alcohol, so you can drink. I mean, although the more you let it sit around and ferment, obviously, the more alcoholic it's going to get. So,
well, the aging of the banana. Well,
we can talk to Greg about that. He sells this stuff to local guys who go out on bicycles and have these huge yellow, like, jerry cans, and they sell the stuff on the street for, like, 50 cents a liter, something like that.
You never know. Maybe at the United Center for the Black Hawks, because, like you said, you're bringing over, kind of connecting people. Maybe there will be a banana beer concession coming up for the
African food doesn't have much of a presence in Chicago yet. I mean, there's some Moroccan restaurants. There's a Nigerian place here and there, but I think that's a cuisine that's yet to make a dent in the Chicago dining scene.
Keeping it on the continent at 3 o'clock, and this is one that I'm excited about. There's a couple opportunities and some possibilities, so if people want to, just kind of get together and put out some positive mojo to have Dr. Hawass on, that would be great. Not positive, and he, of course, was the former minister of antiquities for the man
in Egyptology.
When it comes to any documentary that you've seen, an expert in that field, whenever they're going to go down to talk about either some archaeological dig or anything to go with the pharaohs, like, he is a guy involved. He may be joining us, but regardless, we're going to have the managing director for Abercrombie and Kent from Cairo joining us to talk about Cairo and Egypt as a travel destination. This is, I think, maybe for your more experienced travel, you know, someone who's used to kind of getting out there and seeing the world, not necessarily is it this or is it Wilderness Lodge at the Dells, but it's the kind of thing that I think you have to have all your ducks in a row and lined up, but it's an amazing place to visit.
When people think exotic, I think Egypt is one of the places they think of, because, I mean, the pyramids have been a tourist attraction for centuries, really. People have been going to see these things, and they are indeed magnificent. And some great food to find, too, like falafel. Egyptian falafel is awesome.
Think about putting a shrimp on the Barbie, and this is another part where we've got some friends that are over in Australia getting a chance to check it out. And you know about all the crazy animals, right, that you get over there, whether it's kangaroos or platypuses, you know, stuff like that.
Witchetty grubs. I want to find out if Kate has eaten a witchetty grub, which is like a little worm on the tree. You can only get it in the wild. They don't sell it in restaurants or in grocery stores or anywhere. You have to be in the outback and see it. And they eat them raw off the tree. This is...
Is it a grub in the traditional sense? Like a worm?
Yes.
Okay.
And I looked for them. I couldn't find them. They're very popular among the Aboriginal peoples,
right?
There.
Okay.
They're in the wild.
The witchetty grubs just sounds also like it would be maybe a little league team or something.
Lemony Snicket.
Like a cricket team. Like, they're very popular. They just won the championship. So we'll talk with Kate Webster. She's going to give us a little insight into some off-the-beaten-path stuff in Australia, and certainly a tie-in to the food side, other than just, of course, right, Australian for beer. You think of as, you know, what is the name of that beer? Foster's, right? You think that's it?
Wine. Australia is huge in wine now, and there are great wines coming out of Australia. So, and value, high-value wines, too.
So we'll talk with Kate a little bit about that, and then Aruba. Now, Aruba, I think of, and we talked about it off the air, you know, there's certain places that you say the word and your first word association is whatever it is. I think
Aruba, Jamaica.
Okay, so you think of like a Beach Boys song and John Stamos on drums, I think, for that one, right? But you think, you know, sun, surf, sand, those kind of things. You got an opportunity, and we'll talk with Matt about that, to see sort of I don't want to say it's off the beaten path, right? Things that aren't necessarily in the brochure.
Well, Matt Boland at the Aruba Hilton cooks at a couple of different restaurants there, and he cooks stuff that he knows people are going to like. But he also includes some great local items, and he took us out to some places that I don't think a lot of tourists get to. Some of them are they're in small little neighborhoods tucked away. We'll talk about that.
312-981-7200, your thoughts as well. Places maybe you have gone in 2018 that you want to share, maybe some all-time great places that you've gone, or maybe places that you'd like to go to and maybe want to get a little
bit. And we're talking Scotland too, right?
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about a lot of things, plus just the adventures of David Hammond. So we'll talk about that. We're, you know, you will be our exalted guest when it comes to that segment, because Scotland is a place that I think we have a lot of connections to. But again, I think even though you think haggis, right, you think golf, you think scotch, and certainly all those are there, but there's a lot more to it than that, and we'll hit those as well.
That's pretty much it.
And that's it. Right now, though, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it'll
lovely
be
country.
Super. More show. It is Dane here, 720 WGN. It is Dane here in the Allstate Skyline studio until 5 a.m. And we feel like we are here in the Allstate Skyline studio, but we are going to be taking a tour all around the world, a tour not only talking about travel, transformative travel, some of the things that you get in there, but also a tour for the taste buds as well and some of the indigenous foods. Dave Hammond, he is the dining and drinking editor for New City, is in studio. Of course, does a lot of great stuff for the Tribune as well. Dave, welcome back.
Thank you, Dane. And I'm one of those guys who, when I plan a trip, I'm looking for places to eat while I travel. I mean, what cool little roadside places are there? What restaurants do I want to go to? What foods do I want to eat? And actually, when I went to St. Lucia earlier this year, I was looking for breadfruit, which we're going to be talking about later in the show. Had never cooked it before, bought it, figured out how to cook it.
Does a place have to have an identifiable food scene for you to even want to go there, or is it the fact that they have either beaches or ruins or history, is that enough?
It helps if there's a food, but you know, the thing is, most places, most tradition, and I would say every traditional culture, and even some kind of upstart countries like the United States, have traditional foods, you know, that people like, regionalized foods you can't get elsewhere. Like in Chicago, you get Italian beef, you get corn roll tamales, you get all kinds of things that in other parts of the country they'd never heard of.
So you do a little bit of research and then you kind of map out what it is that you want to do, and you build the food scene into it. Here's the thing that we're going to be doing with the listeners as well, 312-981-7200. David just said he looks for places that he can eat and have great food scenes, but also he is right now kind of auditioning the world for places that he may, longtime resident of the People's Republic of Oak Park, we know that, and a longtime Chicagoan, but I've traveled so many different places, but you're looking for kind of that next place to put down. Maybe they won't be big, giant, long roots, but some roots.
Yeah, I'm thinking, my wife Carol and I are thinking of a short-term stay in some location that will challenge us and also has great food. And I got her almost convinced, I don't think she's listening now, I got her almost convinced that India might be that place. Specifically, Hyderabad, which is like south central India. Google just set up a world India headquarters there. Microsoft has India headquarters there. So it's not like a little backwater. It's a big town. And their main food? Biryani, which is a rice dish you can get all over Chicago. It's like rice with kind of lamb in it, vegetables. Tasty.
You wonder at a place like that where the cuisine is so, it kind of just front, right? So front and center, so big that, you know, okay, here's the kind of difference of it. And I want to get your thoughts on this. Is like America is a melting pot. We embrace the fact that we've got people from everywhere. Here in Chicago, you can get, you know, any kind of cuisine that you want at an elevated level here, and you can do it. We've got variety, right? You can have pizza one day and Peruvian food the next and something else.
Yep.
In a place like India that has really an ancient culture,
right?
Is it all Indian food all the time? And will you have a hard time kind of mixing it up?
That is something I've noticed in travels not only to India but to Thailand, but even Italy, where the tastes are somewhat parochial. They're not as willing to try different foods from different cultures as we are in the United States. And I think that's one of the beauties of the food culture in this country, is that it is so open to trying all kinds of different food. And that you don't find that so much. You're absolutely right, Dane.
Because you can love. I'll go back, and here's my personal example, is I just loved macaroni and cheese. I loved ramen, ate it all through college. Then there came a day where it was just like, I can't do it anymore. And so then I didn't have it maybe for 15 years. And so as much as you may love anything, you know, pizza,
right,
or as much as you may love Indian food, as you may get to a point where I just can't do it.
Oh, I think it'll be that will be the case. That's why I'm only thinking of like a 4 to 6 month sojourn in India. But India is also really close, and this is another consideration for countries we'd like to stay a while, also really close to Java, Sumatra, Indonesia, not a cool place to go now, but hopefully soon, Southeast, all over Southeast Asia, China. I mean, all those are easy places to visit from India. It's kind of centrally located in Asia.
The more places that I get to go, and I have not done anywhere near the amount of travel that you have made it like a big kind of a passion point in your life, and you've traveled in a bunch of different places, and we've talked about quite a few of them. But I'm not one of those people that goes, and of course I've known people and had people with me where you go to a place, you get off the plane, you're there for a couple days, and you think to yourself, man, I love it here. I don't want to leave. I think it's great. A lot of times, the more places I go, the more I appreciate Chicago. You know, not to say that there aren't places that you can love. We'll talk with Sam Choi a little bit later on in the program, and Hawaii was one of the closest ones, but at the time when I was going there a lot, I was younger, and it just seemed a little too slow-paced for me. And so, but we want to bring it up to the listeners, 312-981-7200. Are there places that you could suggest that Dave could consider, or that other listeners could consider, that are the places that if you had to go someplace, and maybe we'll throw that caveat in there, maybe it is not for forever, but maybe for 4 to 6 months.
A long stay. So we're not just tourists. We're actually kind of living there.
Right. You know, where you're going to have to find some means of support, maybe, right? Or just you're going to really have to assimilate. It isn't as though, and we talked about this example, you're not going to be like at Disney World for 6 months straight. You know, you're going to have to kind of be a local.
And I'd kind of dig learning a different language. I mean, having to learn a different language. And that is one slight disability with the life in these United States, comfortable as it is and delicious as it is many times, is you don't really have to learn a foreign language. It's nice if people do, and some do, but I'm guessing less than 10% of the population are fluent in a language other than English. I would like to learn maybe Spanish, maybe Hindi.
Spanish, of course, Mexico, you spent a lot of time there. We'll talk a little bit about some of your travels there, and you mentioned Scotland. We'll talk about some of your travels there. I know a few years ago we were trying to get you on around this time of year, New Year's. You were in Thailand, I think, at the time. And
we were scoping out the living possibilities there. The wife's decision? Too hot. She's Nordic. So it's like, you know, this is like a sweltering jungle, not her idea of a cool place.
But it goes in the family, too. It wasn't your daughter. Actually, she was there as a teacher.
My daughter, Josanna, taught there in Prey. I think that's how you pronounce it. Phrae. But there are like four syllables in there. So it's Prey or something like that. I'm sorry. I'm not making fun of Thai. I just don't know how to speak it.
312-981-7200. Any tips on pronunciation for different languages, plus places that you would love to go and travel and maybe consider for an extended stay, or even maybe that, you know, permanent kind of lifetime relocation. We'll talk about all that stuff, and sometimes the movies are the ways that you get those inspirations. Definitely. And we'll talk some time travel too. WGN. It is Dane here, high atop Chicagoland in the Allstate Skyline studio, where we can see relatively far, especially during the daytime. We could see, I mean, from a travel perspective, probably further than you could walk during a day. I'm not exactly sure. On the line with us, though, and this is it. Dave Hammond in studio with us. Of course, he's the dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine. You read him and know and love a lot of his work in the Tribune as well. And you think about this. How do people get the inspiration, the ideas for what it is that they do or where they want to go? And oftentimes, it's movies. You know, they'll see a movie and they'll say, like, hey, I would love to go there. We were joking off the air that back in a time before the internet, before you could really, you know, with a smartphone or device, almost go anywhere virtually, is that you'd see like Annette Funicello and, you know, Beach Blanket Bingo, and you're thinking, let's say you're growing up in Wisconsin or maybe the suburbs of Chicago, you're like, whoa,
I want to dance on the beach with Frankie Avalon someday.
It's a world away. So I think movies have made a huge impact in inspiring people to get out there, travel, and see the world. And a guy who has done all of that and taken us with him is the one and only Blockbuster, Blake Stubbs. Blake, welcome back to WGN.
Thanks again for having me. I've been a busy lad on WGN as of late. How you doing, sir?
We're doing well. And what's great about what it is that you do, and, you know, of course, you know, having dubbed you Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, but you're not defined by the blockbuster. You're able to kind of go niche in some of these things on the movie side and also on the category side, because I think it was just an idea, and I shared it with you a little earlier today, that, you know, movies that show places that are different from where we are, I think they not only tell that story, whatever's in the movie, but inspire us to want to go there.
Absolutely. And a big thing for me is that, you know, usually whenever you tie in something like, you know, travel, but also food within a movie, you're getting a really sort of a firsthand look at cultures you might not have ever thought you'd experience. And that's one of the magical things I think about films is if they're really good, they're transporting us. And that can be in a lot of different ways. It can be, you know, reminding us of a meal we used to have when we were younger or a place we've always wanted to go that we've had the postcard from sitting, you know, attached to a mirror in our bedroom, whatever it may be. The thing is, I mean, as everybody knows, I'm a movie lover, but I don't just go to watch them simply to come back and talk about them. I go to watch them because I like to enjoy them. I like to go places, sometimes just in the mind. And some of the movies I brought up tonight, I think are going to, people are going to agree with me that they transport. And they're different. They're not all, you know, big blockbuster movies. There's some of them are those niche, like you said, like very independent in spirit. But they also do a very good job, even with little money, of taking us somewhere.
Well, like I wanted to, you know, when I was talking with Dave Hammond about this topic and having you on and all that, and the way that I wrote it, I could certainly see how we would do this. And since you may be thinking the same, because you've said the word transport a couple times, which reminds me, of course, of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And so here's the thing, too, is because I wrote all-time travel movies. And so David took it as we were going to talk all-time travel movies, right? Where I think Back to the Future, you can go back and see your childhood home before you were born.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to say Back to the Future is one of those movies that if you're willing to suspend the disbelief and jump into the time travel world, I don't know how we can, you know, leave that off such a list. And again, maybe it's because I'm a child of the 80s, and it's one of my all-time favorites.
Oh, I think that's a great
absolutely. Very fun. Probably the most fun time travel movie, I think, that you could probably name.
Well, let us not forget Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which is also a time and space travel movie.
With a little bit of history.
That is true.
Yeah,
I was going to say, it's not just about traveling back in time. They kind of go all over the place. And, you know, if you want to venture in, not so much just in movies, but, you know, the Doctor Who universe, and you can pick your doctor, but they definitely try not to stay in one place for too long. Usually it's just one episode. But, yeah, I think if you want to go into that time travel realm, doors open if you want to get creative, that's for sure.
I don't want to throw you off, Blake, because I know that we were thinking about, you know, those kind of movies that have, you know, kind of showcased places and inspired people to travel. So what were you thinking when it came to actually, you know, movies about travel, different places that that people would enjoy or remember?
Well, for one movie that came to mind when you brought up this topic to me, it's more in the documentary realm. It's The Endless Summer. I mean, if you've ever seen the beautiful beaches, the surfing, you know, it's sort of a movie where these people are real. So you think, well, I can go right to that location. And I remember, you know, a couple of years back when I was living out in California, I had a similar experience. Now, it wasn't exactly a perfect endless summer. You know, I wasn't exactly there, but I did visit Venice Beach, California. And how many films have you ever seen where they show Muscle Beach or Venice Beach or any of these places? And you're kind of standing there and it's a little surreal to actually get to be there and feel the sand beneath your feet and see that ocean and everything. It's a really cool experience. And oftentimes when you get a documentary, they aren't showing you something that is too far. It's not out of reach. And you know that, you know, there's an epic story to be told in a way, because documentaries in their best form, you know, tell really good human stories. And to put them in a unique place that you can then visit and experience on your own, there's something special there, I think.
I remember when I was a kid, James Bond movies were a tremendous introduction to exotic locations.
Yes.
Like exotic locations, for instance, like Jamaica, even parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. And in Skyfall, I mean, that opening scene where he's in Istanbul and they're driving motorcycles along the roof. I mean, that made me think, God, I want to go to Istanbul now. It still
works.
Yeah,
and then they turn around and take you to Macau, don't they? And then you're sitting there thinking, wow, like, where are we not going to go, is what you're asking yourself. And again, very stark difference in aesthetic, you know, for the different cultures, the different cities, the design, but also just enrapturing, you know, when you're watching it, you're just like, oh, I want to be there. And hey, that movie was shot by Roger Deakins. So he's going to do his best to put you there. Mm-hmm. And he is. He's one of the all-time greats. So, yeah, no, that's a great pull. I'm a big fan of that film. Yeah.
And it's all background, too. I mean, locations in a Bond movie, they're never like the hero. They're always like just
right,
but fascinating.
And I wanted to ask you, Blake, is that, and I think David kind of hit on it, too, is that it is, you know, it isn't like, hey, James Bond goes to Macau, right? That's not what it is.
Right.
Is that the kind of thing that, and it is, it's so weird that you think about it, because, yes, they always have to have these exotic and beautiful backdrops, along with, you know, the people and the villain and the guy in the volcano and the evil doctor who's trying to take over. You've got all these elements in there, but the travel side of it for James Bond is always huge. Had you ever heard of any of the directors or people making those movies that, and there's been a number as that torch has been handed off over the years, where they said that is an essential element. You know, you've got the martini and the shaken and the stirred and the sports cars and the ladies, but we always have to have in the DNA of a James Bond movie is travel.
It's definitely one of those things that it pops up in conversations about those films, because, you know, depending on how faithful you want the Bond adaptations to be to the books by Ian Fleming and whatever, you know, whether you want that or not, if they're going to have an international spy, he can't be held down by any particular border. He needs to be able to go to all these unique places. He needs to stay fresh. And when, you know, when you've made 20 plus films about him, or you're on the verge of hitting 20 plus, in the mid 20s, whatever, I forget what number they're up to now. It's gotta stay fresh. It's gotta be cool. They need to make sure they change it up. And you know, in the case of Skyfall, that was a big, globe-trotting film.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them have stayed sort of isolated, but in a beautiful location. So, I mean, it may start out in England. Of course, it's going to start out in England. But then he's going to go somewhere.
Ended up in Scotland.
And that sort of changes up. Yeah, and ended up in Scotland. Yeah, and so I think the Highlands of Scotland look gorgeous. In that film. I got to give a lot of that to Roger Deakins. He really is a master at his craft. And being one of the most, I think, nominated people in the Academy's history. He finally won one for Blade Runner, the sequel to Blade Runner 2049 this last year. I think when it comes to Bond, I've definitely heard how, you know, like Daniel Craig has mentioned how cool it is that they get to travel to some of those locations. Other actors, you know, who have the smaller parts, who, you know, they get hired in and then they're only there for like one or two scenes or like a week. But they're like, well, I got to go to this location, and it's like only in a Bond movie. You know, because a Bond movie can just go anywhere. I mean, he's even gone to space. So, and that's Moonraker, you know, just so everybody knows, like, I keep my tabs on the Bond films as best I can. Bond is one of those characters. He just can't be held down. You got to be able to take him to cool, unique, fun places. And I think that even if they are just a background, you know, like a glorified massive soundstage, as long as they're going to actual locations and not using a soundstage all the time, I think that, you know, those movies can stay fresh. And actually, you know, there's no bones about it. You know, movies have sort of led to a hit list of spots I need to, you know, hit. But before my time on this earth is over, I'm really excited to step into that realm here in the next few years.
It's true. I mean, unless you're going to get to, you know, space camp and do the NASA thing, but you look at kind of the situational diversity of it, and you brought up Venice Beach, right, where you're just going to see people rollerblading and maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger or someone who aspires to be him out in front of the place, and then you've got James Bond, the international man of mystery, and you've got those things as well. When we come back from the break, and here's one that came to mind that has, I know, inspired travel, and not necessarily because they wanted to go and emulate, you know, hobbits or anything like that, but think about this. I believe, and we'll talk about it after the break, as well as some of the food side in those places, but when it comes to New Zealand, I think it put them on the map. Some of those movies that, you know, the beautiful landscapes and the mountains and those valleys, it put it as, I think, a travel destination to go there and actually see some of that very unique beauty themselves through those very popular Peter Jackson films. And so hold that point, Blake. I know we're going to talk about it, as well as some of the food in some of these places and some movies that highlight that as well. So we'll be back. We've got Blockbuster Blake Stubbs on the line talking travel and food movies. We've got Dave Hammond in studio. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN is Dane here, Allstate Skyline Studio, and David Hammond in studio with us. Blockbuster Blake Stubbs on the line as we talk kind of transformative travel in the movies, and also building in a little bit of the tour for the taste buds as well. Blake, welcome back.
Thanks again for having me.
When we went to the break, and I know David and I were talking about it, as well, as much as maybe the James Bond movies kind of highlighted really cool places around the world, I think those, you know, Lord of the Rings movies, you know, that happened in New Zealand kind of put them on the map. Like, I don't know that people knew that kind of level of nature, of scenery, was, you know, even existed right before those films.
I was going to say, it certainly acted as a very big sounding board for the beauty that exists in New Zealand. And I mean, look, the New Zealand Tourism Board, and I don't even know if that's the actual name of the organization, but the whoever handles tourism for New Zealand embraced those films in an immense way. I mean, they were painting every one of the planes that would fly you into New Zealand with characters from the film. They were trying to make sure that people, they made some really hilarious long form commercials that would play, you know, on the web and everywhere you could really get your hands on, as long as they were willing to throw money at it. You just put out there that, like, look, what you saw in those films, you can experience firsthand. And two of my very close friends, after they married each other, that was where they spent their honeymoon. And the whole point was they wanted to kind of do part of the Lord of the Rings, you know, tour, but then they also wanted to sort of explore. They wanted to sort of do their own thing. And they came back from it and they said, look, I mean, the Lord of the Rings stuff was awesome because we're big movie fans and everything. But getting to just kind of explore that country, you know, it opened up a lot more than we ever thought it would. And I think now, though, they're more than ready to welcome in, you know, the curious traveler. I think they're more than ready to offer an experience that, you know, is going to be full of memories that'll last a lifetime.
On the wedding package side, of course, you have Gandalf performs the ceremony, and then you've got, and then when they do that, if anybody has anything, you know, to say, speak now. And then I think one of the, like, evil bad guy, orcs would jump up and say something. It's really. I have had a chance to interview the ambassador of New Zealand before, and their food and wine, whether it was the lamb and the wines and the scallops and the seafood, was kind of front and center. And David, your thoughts on that? You know, that's another.
Yeah,
movies may have been like the entry point, but the food is really what they have.
You know, one thing that, not to ride this James Bond pony too long, but one thing that kind of disappoints me in the current James Bond movies, which was not true of the Ian Fleming books, is they don't focus much on food. In the books, Ian Fleming would sometimes go into elaborate descriptions of this incredible food, and that kind of got me into food in some ways, because I read all those books when I was in junior high school. In the movies, though, you don't see much of it. In fact, I don't think Daniel Craig eats a single bite in Skyfall, and I'm furious.
So,
and that's the thing, too. You would think that as sophisticated as he is as a spy, and it makes for great dialogue, you know, that he can fit into almost any situation because he knows so much about the culinary arts and all this other stuff. It's like they want to barely tease it in the films, and I'll never quite understand that either.
It's
very good that you point that out.
Maybe it's kind of awkward, too, to have people chowing down on screen when they're saving the world.
I don't know. And now, Blake, you can speak. There's only so much, you know, I guess, cinematic real estate in a film. And do they say, like, well, we could do one more car chase, or we could serve restaurants. And then they go, like, well, we'll do the car chase. Is that it, you think?
It probably is. I mean, eventually, though, they got to realize that it's cheaper to just have them sit down at a fine meal and maybe have a couple of lines of dialogue about it and then move on. I can think of maybe a few scenes in, like, Casino Royale, like in the really nice hotel, you know, like after the poker game and all that stuff. Like, fine. Mm-hmm. But they don't really hang too long. We don't really get a sense of, you know, what does 007 dine on after he's been poisoned, had to use a defibrillator on himself, and then, you know, win a poker game
Chinese,
with immense
stakes. I'm guessing he's Chinese.
And then the other thing is, and then he's, you know, really tortured after that, and you got to wonder, you know, that all that food sat pretty well despite the immense torture. So
nothing builds up an appetite like near death torture,
like hours of torture, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, another cool, another kind of cool place setting for a movie, and this is going back, and this is for, I think, the real film buffs, is I Was a Male War Bride with Cary Grant. It's like 1949. It was set in bombed out Berlin. I mean, it was like Berlin, post-war Berlin. The city's destroyed. It was a great peek at that place at that period of time. And it was all backdrop to Cary Grant dressed like a girl.
I have never seen this, but it's a Howard Hawks film.
Howard Hawks, yep.
Well, it's on my list. Thank you. You've given me my homework for this week. So, I appreciate it.
So, the you know, Cary Grant dressed as a lady in bombed out Berlin was not necessarily on your list going into this segment, but I know you've got a couple of other ones that you wanted to share before we head to news.
Yeah, there's one in particular. It's called The Trip. And I'm sure David's heard of this film. Yes. If he hasn't seen it. It started as like a series, and then they turned it into a film. It was sort of built to be that with both forms of the story. It stars Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. It's directed by Michael Winterbottom. And it's these two brilliant, I think they're two of the finest comedians of their generation, also actors, very good actors. And they have to just travel around to different resorts throughout Europe and eat, you know, beautiful food. They talk about the food. They get into Michael Caine impersonation battles. It's a thing where it's very human, but it's also just, it's beautifully shot, acted. It's just one of those movies. I remember watching the series. I never actually saw the film until years later, but the series was very rich. It's like six episodes long. They're short. I think they're like half hour episodes. But when they cut it down into a film, it was a much more, I think, succinct version of what they were trying to accomplish. And still, though, great meals. They're always kind of a part of the conversation, because what's happening is Steve Coogan, who's playing himself, has to like write about all these different meals that he's having in these different places. You know, sort of showcase the uniqueness of the different areas of the UK. And then in the second, they did a sequel, and then they travel a little bit further, I believe, in that one. So I would highly recommend The Trip if you're looking for an easy, fun little watch.
It's hilarious.
You know, a couple of funny guys being funny. And hey, there's going to be some cool ideas for meals, thanks to the stuff that they eat. So yeah, it's a really cool movie. I love pushing people toward that one.
A little bit later on in the show, we are going to talk with people from, Greg is going to be calling from Rwanda, and apparently has an amazing banana beer that we're gonna talk into. But I think too, whether it's like The English Patient or Out of Africa or some of those that kind of, you know, offered in a cinematic way, those just kind of sweeping in a non-documentary setting, you know, was built into a story.
Yeah.
Just some of the vistas and the Serengeti and the plains and the animals. And I think that had to inspire some people to get involved and maybe even go to Africa.
Absolutely. And the thing is, if you make a movie and you photograph something beautifully, it's going to stick in the mind of the viewer. And oftentimes, if you're able to showcase a rich environment, nowadays we live in an era where you can just Google it and think, ooh, I can go. And then you can sometimes be surprised how cheap it is to get there. That's an interesting thing to point out. You know, movies can kind of be that killer launch pad to send you on a brand new adventure. And I think that's a very good point.
You know, and about adventures, too, a lot of us watched Westerns as kids, and that was all about the promise of the West. And I think, I mean, California is still a very popular place to go, despite earthquakes and fires and cost of living and so on. People still want to go there, and the beach movies probably played a part in that. But I think the Western also played a part in that, because it's about going west, which brings me to The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Oh, nice.
On Netflix.
Yes.
Which... I've met some people who don't like it. I watched it, and then I immediately watched it again. I just thought it was so fantastic. What a portrayal of the American West, and what plays on the stereotypes, cliches, or archetypes, if you will, of that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. That movie is hands down one of the finest films of the year.
Wow.
It just is. And that's my opinion, but I'm not alone in that. I mean, if you go out and read any critical review, if you like reading reviews of movies, and I know that some people out there really do, you will find that Buster Scruggs is a loved film by critics. I can see why some people don't enjoy it. I don't know that everybody understood that The Ballad of Buster Scruggs was going to be an anthology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they thought that, you know, certain characters were going to be with them throughout the whole movie. No, it's an anthology. It's a series of stories that's told in a very, and each one in quite succinct fashion. The Coen brothers are really on their game in this, and I think a lot of it had to do with Netflix, who, you know, helped produce it, I believe, or at least distribute it.
I think that's true.
Whoever produced this, let the Coen brothers be the Coen brothers. And when those guys get inside their zone, it's there's nothing stopping them, for one. And two, their tricks still work. All the stuff that they do as storytellers still clicks and it still works, especially when they have, you know, and they've worked with, like, every kind of budget you can think of. They've worked with every great actor you could think of. At this point, right now, I think my hero this year in the acting world is Tom Waits. To be honest, performance in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs
is the old prospector.
Yeah, yes, hands down, probably my favorite thing I saw this year. Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
And our person, Eileen Ogans from TakingTheKids.com, we have her on a regular basis talking about travel with the kids and the road trip. And you got to figure shows like this, you know, and movies that portray sort of that Wild West kind of thing inspire people to go to dude ranches, you know, where they get out there and they want to rope some doggies. And I don't know if they have all, if you can do some kind of gunfight or anything like that, you know, or you get to like knock somebody out
in
of
Westworld.
In Westworld.
I'm not sure. So, Blake, thanks again so much for sharing what it is and transporting us, maybe not back in time, but certainly around the world, and give the social media again so people can continue that conversation.
Absolutely. You can find me on Twitter at Blake Stubbs. That's BLAKESTUBBS. BLAKESTUBBS. And by the way, guys, thanks a lot. This was a lot of fun. Yeah. I actually want to do segments like this a lot more. This was a blast. Thanks.
All right. 720 WGN high atop Chicagoland and the Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. In studio, we do have the dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine and contribute to our very own Chicago Tribune, David Hammond.
Hello.
And on the line with us, and this is, it's always a pleasure. He's one of my favorite people on the planet, one of the greatest chefs that is out there, a James Beard Award winner, and a guy who, I got to tell Sam, too, that, you know, we're at about 50 degrees, so we're not doing that bad as far as weather-wise, but he is one of Hawaii's greatest natural resources. Chef Sam Choi, welcome to WGN.
Hey, aloha. Yeah, that's not bad, 50.
No.
We get down into the 50s.
Like springtime.
In Kona, where I live, yeah.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah, so we feel pretty good about it. If you flash back to this exact time last year, I remember, I think we're at about 10 below zero. So we're doing, so global warming, it kind of works.
Might as well enjoy the end of the world.
Yeah, well, so here's the thing. So, Sam, you are always in paradise, you know, in Kona, but you do travel out there. Not only do you share some of the stuff you're doing on the food side, but some of those great food movements. And we've talked at length. Poke is alive and well here in Chicago.
Very positive.
So talk about kind of what you're doing with that and how's it going in Hawaii and you're bringing it to other places.
Well, I tell you what, it's been really a magical ride, you know, way back when I first kind of like not only had the opportunity to share this dish, but wrote some books on it and studied it, you know, went from South America with a ceviche movement and then come to the Polynesian islands and find them kind of like getting closer to how we have it and do it in Hawaii and to see it where today, you know, my whole vision was always to kind of keep in mind that sushi and sashimi has kind of like been a household name around the world, you know, and where does poke fit in, you know, back then? And today, boy, I always get a smile on my face when I hear there's a new poke store opening up or shop or restaurant opening up and kind of like watch the path, you know, like it just kind of like moving like a freight train, you know, getting out of control, man. It's just amazing. But I think the real magical part of it is just the people have kind of made that happen. It's because of not only the simplicity of it, but the freshness and, more importantly, the health part of it. Right. You know, you don't have to be, the rice don't have to be involved like a sushi or, you know, like some other Japanese dishes. We got a lot of rice, but now we do serve it with rice bowls, you know, but you also can have it on salad. And you know, it's a great real quick meal. You know, shaker salads are great. That's what we're doing up in Seattle. You know, have the poke in these bowls that you have the dressing, the salad, the, you know, just shake it and you got yourself a nice poke salad, you know, just real simple. But yeah, so the movement's really exciting. I like to see, you know, it, you know, I've been getting a lot of questions like, is it just, you know, a flash in a pan? Or I says, no, it's here to stay.
Just like sushi, I mean, and a lot sashimi, of it, they're not going away anytime soon.
Oh, no, they're not going away. It's like Chinese food, man. You know, it's not going away. It's here to stay.
We're not.
You know, and go ahead.
Oh, excuse me, Sam. I was in Oahu earlier this year staying at Alohalani on Waikiki Beach. And the chef there was making, we made some poke when we were there. And he added a nut to it. I think it's kikuyu nut. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah. Yes, it's kikuyu nut, which is a candle nut.
A candle
it's roasted,
right.
And then it's
Now he was saying
it's roasted, and then it's go ahead.
He was saying that you can't really make poke without this nut, and I don't think I've ever had that nut in poke in the United States. And I wonder why it might be felt that that nut is so important. And do you feel that you really it's really good to have that nut or something like it, maybe peanut butter or something?
Well, very good. You tapped on peanut butter. So basically, when you look at the traditional poke, it is the sodium, which was the sea salt. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they had the sea salad, which is kind of like was grown on the reefs, mm-hmm. and then chopped to get the crunch, to get that texture in there. And then you think about it, the only other flavoring they added besides the sea salt was the inamona, which was the candle nut that was roasted and then ground up and put into the poke. Now, that was before Captain Cook, that poke, that kind of style of poke.
Oh.
I like, that's kind of like one of my favorite pokes to eat. And so now let me take you back a little more now to today, not take you back, but bring you up to speed. So in the place of the kukui nut, you can use, you mentioned it, peanut mm-hmm. butter, sesame seed oil. So those are the two nutty nuts that you can have that flavor.
You want
to
that
replace
nut,
the
you want that nutty,
nut.
Yeah, you want that nutty flavor in there in some way.
Right. It adds. Yes, it adds a nice creamy flavor to mm-hmm. the poke, especially when you got fresh tuna. You know that yellow fin tuna, mm-hmm. or you know the small other red fish. And then the other magic part of it, the sea salt, is substituted by soy sauce. So that's where the Asian influence in Hawaii has played to that dish, you know, and that's what makes poke so unique. You know, you can have the guys get the inamona shipped out to wherever they're having poke made, but then there's also a substitute of either the peanut butter or the sesame seed oil, and that kind of like. Go ahead.
Well, no, but I think that that's one of the things that you have done, too. You've got that history, and you've got ways that people are able to enjoy it and let the listeners know. We're talking with Chef Sam Choi live from Hawaii. But part of what you're doing as the ambassador to it is, and it seems like it's coming through, right, is that, you know, whatever makes it work for you is that there aren't any rules. You know, there are some things that are essentials that are built into it and ways that people can love it traditionally. But any way that you can incorporate it into what you do on the food side, hey, you're better for it because like you said, you've got the fish side of it, you've got the fruit side of it, you've just got those health properties too. It's good to do.
Right. Very well said. But the other thing that really kind of like gets me excited is making sure that they're using as fresh poke as possible, tuna, I mean. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, making sure that they can pronounce it right. It's not poke, it's poke.
Or poke.
You know, to do that. Because I think if you're in the Philippines and you say poke, you might be in trouble. You know, that's it's not a good word. If they say poke, I mean, if they say it right and spell it right, I think it's fine. Everything else is kind of like up to the talented chefs of America or the talented chefs of the world, where they can add their little touch to it, their little, you know. I mean, for the gentleman that said that, or, you know, if you don't have the inamona, then that's not a true poke. To a lot of you know, saying of that is that, you know, there is some truth to that. But as talented as chefs are today, you can use the peanut butter. My dad, that's the first guy introduced me to the poke with peanut butter was through my dad. Hmm. Because my grandfather, from way back when, you know, we're talking in the 1800s, you know, so that's what really got me excited. And I think Emeril Lagasse, we did it one time on his show, and we used the peanut butter. And every now and then when we do talk or we do get a chance to call each other, he'll go like, how's that peanut butter poke? You know, so, you know, people may laugh, but then it has that nutty flavor of that Inamona.
You mentioned, Sam, you know, how there's a point of pride there when you see just how this movement is happening around the world. It's been embraced and knowing where it came from and knowing that you've been a driving force of it. When you had mentioned, we communicated a little bit earlier today, and you wanted to bring another thing up, right, that hopefully you're going to be able to kind of share with the rest of the world in certain ways, is the breadfruit. And I'm thinking that's going to be a tougher sell, but let's hear it. You know, what is the future of the breadfruit movement?
I tell you what, breadfruit right now is on fire. They've had many great conferences already on breadfruit, and the real reason for that is it's gluten-free, and it also is a high part of the gluten-free family. And the Mafala, I don't use the word brand, but species of the breadfruit, which is like 256 different species of breadfruit, the Mafala has vitamin C in it. So, you know, the health part of that is just amazing. It's the purest form of gluten-free. So there's companies now getting flour being made. They're having baked products already made. The conference that we're working on right now that's going to be out in St. Croix with Chef Todd, who created a vodka called Mutiny that is on fire right now with the breadfruit. So
that's funny because,
you know,
I think
everything that potato has been, you know, used in, Ulu breadfruit can do the same thing, but with a larger and a more healthier, you know, part of it.
That name Mutiny is
amazing.
Funny, isn't it?
It's
That name Mutiny is funny because I believe it was Captain Bligh on the Bounty that had the famous Mutiny,
which is a true story. They all ended up in Pitcairn,
and
yeah.
he brought breadfruit to the Caribbean, I believe, didn't he?
That's right. So, you know, that's why a lot of times when I talk about the breadfruit movement, guys go like, "What's Ulu?" I said, "That's the breadfruit." Well, you know, so how does it look? Where does it grow? I says, you watch the show Mutiny and the Bounty? They goes, oh, yeah. I said, mm-hmm. That was the breadfruit.
Lived on breadfruit.
That's what they came and got. Yeah.
I was in St. Lucia.
Yeah, so
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was in St. Lucia earlier this year, and I saw some breadfruit, and I had never actually seen it before, but I thought, I'm going to bring some back to my hotel, and I'm going to cook some. So I basically just cut it up in a pan, cut it up in a pan with water, and I put it in the oven for X amount of time. And I could see how, with some great sauce on top or some protein, how it would be a quite delicious carbohydrate platform.
Yeah, you know, you have... I don't want to use the word you haven't seen yet, but there's some talented people that are using breadfruit today. I'm still waiting for like a big company like a McDonald's use that as a fry.
Like
French fries use the Ulu fries. I mean, it is amazing. The Ulu fries are amazing.
Well, here's
Ulu chips. Ulu chips are just amazing.
I don't think they sell.
And the other thing that's amazing.
Yeah, I don't think that. No,
well, see, the problem with the breadfruit is that it's seasonal, so it has a window. So they're working on it right now to have it where it can be, you know, moved to a different parts of the world where they can grow it to produce that. You know, look at potato. You know how well they've done to make sure the world can get potatoes 24/7. And that's going to happen with breadfruit. You know, it's just amazing. The only time people ever saw breadfruit was when it was splattered on the ground because it was overripe and fell to the ground. And they go, oh, what's that? And I said, well, that's breadfruit, but they should have picked it earlier. But, yeah, I'm really excited about it. I think it has the same kind of footprint or legs like what poke has been doing. So I'm really excited because of the health part of it. You know, the gluten-free is just amazing.
Well, you would know, and let the listeners know, we're talking with Chef Sam Choi live from Kona. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things on the food side to be sure to experience when you get a chance to travel and visit Hawaii. Certainly the poke in its most traditional and revered forms, and breadfruit, right? You can do all that
stuff. Loco moco.
And all that stuff.
Love it.
That's right. Loco moco, man. Poke moco. Loco moco. There's a million mocos.
Well, Sam, hold tight. We're going to take just a couple-minute break. We're going to come back more with Sam Choi live from Kona. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, high atop Chicagoland in the Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. David Hammond in studio as well. And at night, we reach 38 states in Canada. And for the next, 7-8 minutes, we're going to reach all the way to the Hawaiian Islands. We've got James Beard Award winner, one of the greatest all-time chefs and certainly one of our favorite personalities, the one and only Chef Sam Choi. Welcome back.
Thank you. I learned a lot about Chicago. I'm only kidding.
you know where to get certain things in groceries, and you know that the Blackhawks are playing and all those kind of things. But a lot of people here, you know, we're
that's great. That's wonderful.
Well, a lot of the people that are hearing this, some of them are going to do those things. So many more would love to join you out in Hawaii. And so let's talk a little bit about, for people that are food fans coming to Hawaii, so much beautiful scenery and the beaches and the volcanoes. But on the food side, what are some things that people should be sure not to miss when they visit you?
Loco moco.
Well, one of the things that really made Hawaii so unique is that when you look at all the ethnic groups that came to Hawaii, along with their culture, they brought their food. So it is definitely the mix, you know, it's definitely a mixed plate, you know, so you have different, you know, variations of different styles of food on the plates. And on the other hand, I think a lot of the younger chefs today and some of the older ones, like the famous Hawaii regional chefs, have really kept to the, you know, the idea of making sure that we had a little touch of everything. But let's not forget where we are. We're in Hawaii. So let us get things that are, you know, indigenous to the islands, you know, like some of the different vegetables and things like that we have here. Mm-hmm. But like Loco Moco, for a good example, which is a Hilo original, it's just amazing how that has just gone almost like poke all around the world, you know.
And
just little rice, little burger mm-hmm. patty, mm-hmm. Pan gravy, an egg on the top, and some fried onions, and you have yourself a power breakfast or a power lunch. Yeah,
and it's now served at several places in Chicago.
Pardon?
It's now being served at several places in Chicago. Aloha Poke and Aloha Wagon are both serving Loco Moco. As Chef said, it's just two hamburger patties on on some rice with gravy and sometimes coleslaw or onions or something. It's delicious. It's just delicious.
Oh, yeah, it is. Mac salad, the famous island style Mac salad, using Best Food mayonnaise, of course, or Hellman's. But anyway, you know, in Hawaii, you look at, like, you have, man, you want to see a poke movement, you watch the Taniokas over in Waipao. There's a line at that door from the time they open to the time they close. I mean, and then all the local markets, Foodland, you know, they've had their bragging rights of being the best poke in markets. Safeway, they have poke there. I mean, so for our travelers who are coming from Chicago when the weather's really nasty out there and come and get some nice sun and some nice beach and you know, in the old days, that's how they promoted Hawaii, but not anymore. The food movement is just amazing. I mean, there's a lot of great chefs out here in Hawaii, boy, I tell you, it's just, and they really have taken their time to understand and study what the people that are traveling through the islands want. You know, and you know, today with what you folks do on your millions of listeners that are listening, and you know, it's just important to have them understand before they come out here, they know exactly what they want. You know, and that's what's really unique with food today. I mean, from Food Network to what you guys do daily, and of course all the articles that are printed, you know, all the different kind of foods that are unique. I mean, let's just stop at poke. I mean, if it ain't fresh, it ain't poke. That's my new thing, you know. Because I've been to a lot of poke places around town, you know. I mean, around the country, you know. And I'm like, You know, we just opened up in San Francisco, in San Bruno, you know, right across of, you know, YouTube, and it's a very hot spot, but it's been a really exciting movement, you know. We got an opening coming up in New Zealand, and, you know, we're looking at Okinawa and in Japan, you know, so, and we own Seattle. I don't want to say we own it, but we own Seattle with Poke. Yeah, San Jose Poke to the max. It's on fire out there.
Wow.
And, you know, I just have to give a lot of thanks to people like you folks who really go and dig into stuff like that, you know, just, have the, you know, I don't use the word guts, but just have the knowledge of, hey, we got to get this, the knowledge of getting this thing out there, mm-hmm. acknowledge, you know, the food concept and stuff like that. So, you know, give praise to you guys, you know.
Well, Sam.
Because, you know, we can only, yeah.
Well, here's the thing, too, is, and part of it is, you know, you want to go to Hawaii, you want to see, you know, the beaches and the volcano and all the natural beauty and everything, but people are traveling a lot of times for the food thing. And you mentioned on the writing side of it, and Dave, you wrote a recent article in the Tribune about the street food.
Street food in Oahu, yeah. Locomoco, but also...
Oh, yeah, the street...
Yeah.
Yeah. They have a big spam festival. They have a big spam festival.
Yes. I think a lot of Chicagoans, perhaps even many mainlanders, would be surprised to know that spam is huge in the islands. Spam musubi?
You know, spam musubi. They lit up, you know, Hormel over in Austin, Minnesota, which I was there for the 120th or 125th, you know, anniversary of spam. Basically, spam means spicy ham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what spam means.
It's indigenous
and,
to Minnesota.
And the nice thing about it is, a lot of people, though, I've come across, they go like, hey, you're the spam guy. I think I said that maybe last time we were on air.
Yes, you did.
But in the beginning, when spam, I got on Dateline because of spam, you know, doing the spam moko and all that, and spam musubi. And I told my guys, I said, man, I don't want to be noted for spam, you know. And then I was walking through the airport in Minnesota, and the guy early in the morning, man, a real cold winter morning, and the guy looked up at me as, you know, mopping up the airport. He looked at me and go, yo, the spam man.
Oh, man.
And I came back and said, I want to be the spam man, you know.
Be the poke.
But, yeah,
man.
It's just, you know, street food in Hawaii is amazing. Electricity. I mean, it's just from the farmers markets now. The farmers markets have really exploded that part of it too. There's farmers markets that only allow people that sell things that are grown or raised in Hawaii. So that's really nice because, you know, the whole mission is to offer a true taste of Hawaii.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's like in the old days when people would buy all these knickknacks and all these things that they would get at international marketplace or what. And then halfway on their flight, they go like, oh, let me get up in that bag and then bring it down. And they turn it over. There's a sticker made in China, made in Hong Kong, made in the Philippines. I mean, they're going like, what? We spent, you know, not thousands. We spent a few dollars and all these dang things came from another country. We don't want to do that with the food.
Well, here's,
we want to make sure when people come there, they have their true taste of Hawaii.
Well, the true taste and the authentic taste, the authentic flavor of Hawaii and Sam Choi is every bit of that. And Sam, before we let you go, you know, give the information out. We're going to definitely have a link up at WGNradio.com so people can learn about Poke to the Max and all the different movements and the breadfruit movement and the conference and all that. But social media wise, before we let you go, where can people follow all your adventures?
Well, I'm on really simple, schefchoy@gmail.com, and on my IG is just Chef Sam Choi.
And
that's it.
And you have the most amazing pictures. You are walking the walk every day on Instagram, and I would definitely recommend people check that out. It is a great way to experience a lot of the fun things and the delicious things that Sam Choi is doing every day on Instagram. So thanks, Chef. We're going to let you get back to
Thank you, Chef.
We're going to continue our world tour for the Taste Buds, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Chef, for jumping on the show today.
Hey, thank you, and keep up the great job you guys are doing, and Happy New Year, and most importantly, if it ain't fresh, it ain't poke.
If it ain't fresh, it ain't poke.
You heard it here. Thanks, Sam. We'll talk to you soon.
See you, man.
Okay, thanks. Aloha. Bye.
All right, it is 2:30, and when we come back from the news, we are going to go from Hawaii. I guess it would be left, your left, my right, as far as if you've got your globes out, we're going to head to Rwanda. We've got Greg there from Red Rocks in Rwanda. We'll hear about the banana beer and so much more happening in Africa, so keep it here.
world to the sunset in your eyes. Traveling the train through clear Moroccan skies.
Look at that. Moroccan sky. That is Africa 720. WGN high atop Chicagoland in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is Daniel here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio, and alongside for the duration of the program is Dave Hammond. He is the dining and drinking editor for New City and a contributor to the Chicago Tribune. And we're going to talk a little bit of Africa in a couple of these different segments. Kate Webster coming up a little bit later. It's going to handle, she's from Australia. She's going to be talking about that as a destination. And then we're going to have Greg, we're hooking him up at some point within the next 20 minutes. We're going to have Greg on from Red Rocks in Rwanda. And Dave, I can't tell you, there's probably no more maybe mysterious place that we are already aware of. You know, there's going to be places we've never heard of that I think might be maybe more mysterious. But Africa is one of those that we've all heard of. We all have, you know, immediate pictures that come to mind in a bunch of different ways, right? There's so many different places in it. But it's a place I think we all at some point inside, we want to go check it out, you know, whether it's the nature, the animals, the people, the culture, the food, right? And you've done that.
The food is fascinating, although I think it's the wildlife that is one of the great allures of Africa, because that's something you can't get anywhere else. And when we were in Rwanda a couple of months ago, we went to a Volcanoes National Park where they have gorilla trekking, which is you pay your money, you get suited up, and you go with a group of porters and a guide into the mountains to find gorilla families. And there's a number of gorilla families living on the hills in Volcanoes National Park. We came upon this family, walked in like 45 minutes or so, and we were in the center of this family of gorillas in the trees, on the ground, eating thistles, which aren't bad, incidentally, if you're in the wild. They're kind of refreshing. They're like a moist celery. And this, I was looking at this one big silverback gorilla, and he was eating a thistle. And as I was looking at him, another gorilla banged into me from behind. I mean, we were that close.
Wait a minute. Actually bumped
like hit me in the thigh. He was just walking along. He was going somewhere else, and he was totally undisturbed by that, which I thought was awesome. And I was totally cool with his being cool about it, too. I'm glad I didn't, like, get in his way. But being that close to these incredible creatures was one of the most powerful experiences. In fact, when we were there, after we went to see these gorillas, we're walking out of the jungle, there's a team of documentarians there. They broke out crying. I mean, it was just so, I mean, it sounds like, well, it was so emotional.
For you, and I think for anybody, this would be exciting stuff, right? For all the people that have ever been to a zoo and you get an opportunity to see these animals in person.
And be touched by a gorilla.
To have an opportunity to be that up close and personal, I think would be amazing. But think about this, and I'm sure that's why they broke down crying. If this is your life's work, you know, and this is what it is that you do and you study, and you have that opportunity to have them be that close, it has to be absolutely amazing. Now, here's the thing. So we bring the kids to the zoo. We've got some great zoos here, whether it's, you know, Brookfield Zoo, whether it's Lincoln Park Zoo, and Maxwell, and you know Maxwell mm-hmm. pretty well
yeah,
over the years.
Cool guy.
And so apparently to cheetahs, he's delicious, or to lions, right? He looks, wherever we go, they see him and their eyes like focus on him, and maybe it's because he's kind of wimpy, and maybe they feel that he'd be an easy
meal. He's not listening.
Well, nah, he knows it. Anyway, I don't know. He's getting tougher, I guess. But either way, if you're a lion, of all of the family here, he just seemed like the most
delicious.
Yeah, big enough to be worth it, right? Because Vivian is a little small person, but not so big that maybe you'd, you know, have to kind of fight for it. And
you're assessing your son's deliciousness potential with a wild beast.
His level of edibility. And but so we're always kind of like, okay, it's kind of worth, like, what would happen if, you know, one of the animals, you know, got out and you had to necessarily, like, deal with it in kind of a confrontational situation. You hear those stories of the guy that's throwing the rocks in the San Francisco Zoo at the tiger, and then the tiger decides, hey, I could really jump this 12-foot fence, and does. And so for you personally, I would be in awe. It would be amazing. I'd be kind of scared, right? Because just one false move, or if it just happened to, you just happened to kind of make a bad impression to the gorilla.
Make a bad impression. I mean, first impressions are important with gorillas.
Inadvertently, you know, let's say, because you never know in the social hierarchy of things. Maybe if you're, you know, don't look them in the eye. I mean, I don't know what it is, but
well,
either way, I'd be worried.
If if a gorilla were to get angry, you don't want to return anger with anger, of course. What you do want to do is get very small. Like, don't, you know, get as tiny as you can be, walk backwards, and do not make eye contact. That is, be totally submissive. You're not going to win a fight with a gorilla.
Right.
I mean, these guys are as big as a Volvo. I mean, they're huge creatures.
And just even like a chimpanzee, we hear those stories, and you've heard some of the news stories, you know, when they've gone kind of crazy.
Berserk. Yeah.
Yeah, is that even a chimpanzee, which is, I think, smaller physically than a person, is still like seven times stronger, you know, than
and
a man.
Fast.
Yeah,
very fast.
Mm-hmm. Did they run through some of that with you?
They did. Like they did. And we were very, I mean, we were all very careful not to do anything that would be at all annoying to the gorillas while we were there. Something kind of cool about it, the porters on this gorilla trek were former poachers. That is, they used as porters on this trek guys who had previously hunted down gorilla families, killed most of the family, taken the babies, and sold them to crazy rich Americans or whomever.
Are these rehabilitated poachers?
Yes,
or just poachers that, you know, are in between jobs, you know, running out of here? Well, no, because the government has cracked down in some ways.
It's a way of doing penance, I think, but it's also a job, and they realize we're going to make more money bringing tourists in here than we ever made killing gorillas and selling the babies. So it makes economic sense. And Rwanda is on an economic tear right now. They're billing themselves as the Singapore of Africa. I mean, the roads are great. They're inviting business in there. And it was a very pleasant place to be. I'd love to go back. I don't know that I ever will. And here's something else that's really interesting. I don't know if Greg will get to this. We don't have him yet, do we? 1994, Rwanda had the most concentrated genocide in the history of the world. 1 million people were killed in a month's period in 1994, and a lot of it was neighbor on neighbor. Hutus killing Tutsis, frequently with machetes. You know, so the nice old man that was playing with your kids a day ago is now hacking them to pieces, and that's not an exaggeration.
Right.
But they've realized that the only way they're going to advance as a nation and join, you know, the prosperous nations of the world is to forgive. And I think, I mean, a lot of the bad men and women who were responsible for that did have to go to jail or they faced some kind of punishment. They're not out in the open. Some of them just had to be let free. They had 250,000 people in a relocation center in Uganda, people who had been suspected of committing atrocities. You could take every lawyer in the United States and send them to Rwanda. They couldn't try those cases in any amount of time. So they took the bad guys. They took care of them. They let the rest go with the admonition, let's love one another, and we can advance. And I think that, and it's, they seem to have done that. I mean, they're not forgetting the genocide. There are genocide museums all over the country. But they know that to succeed, they can't be Tutsis, they can't be Hutus, they got to be Rwandans.
If we learn anything from Blake Stubbs in our movie segment, you know, it was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, right? It's be excellent to each other.
Be excellent to one another.
And if you just apply that philosophy, you
golden
can do it.
Rule.
From an interview standpoint, I think it would be really interesting, I mean, fascinating, right, to talk to even some of these poachers and just get that mindset and see if they're conflicted. Certainly market forces apply, and it's just a different world, right? You just need to do things that I think would just be impossible to understand, like how you could get to that point where there's other things to do, but maybe in some of those cultures there isn't. But it is so important, and I think for us to be able to share this message, you know, and this trip, and we'll get Greg on and we'll talk a little bit about it as well, and you being able to do it, because isn't that the answer, is to make the, you know, these animals more valuable as kind of their own ambassadors for on the tourism side, rather than whatever you could extract, you know, out of like their body parts. And then
that's true. That's true. I mean, there's more. For instance, this trip to see the gorillas, it went from $750 for like a 4-hour, half a day trip to $1,500. So it's not inexpensive, but that's a lot of revenue coming into the country, and it goes to help sustain the gorilla population.
And if you get the leaders, you know, some of the governmental leaders that are on board with that, because sometimes
they sure are.
You have, whether it's just, you know, general corruption or dysfunction or whatever it is from the top down, it's nice to see some of those things. So when it comes to Red Rocks, and we're going to take a break and we're going to try to see if we can connect, you know, we've got some phone numbers with a lot of extra numbers in them that we're trying to connect with Greg over there at Red Rocks. But for his place, and you got a chance to experience it, I've seen it online, and we'll have links up.
It's a cool place.
It's like a campground combination public service center.
He's helping the community. He's built schools. He's built places for HIV patients to stay, and he makes a hell of a banana beer.
That's right. We've certainly
to be continued.
Yeah, we've extolled the virtues of the banana beer. That's neither beer nor banana flavored, right? Apparently,
but it is made out of bananas.
It is made out of bananas, technically. So we've got the proof there. It is right now. It is about 15 minutes to 3 o'clock. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Rwanda and Africa and preview some of the things that are going on. We may get into some of David's adventures in Scotland and Mexico as well. So keep it here. It's On the Road. Well, actually, it's just me here, right? 720 WGN. Nice Led Zeppelin. Dan, is this the second Led Zeppelin song you played as a bumper?
Yeah.
Dave's the nodding yes.
Love that Zepp.
He's keeping track of it. 720 WGN, high at time, Chicago Allstate Skyline Studio. Dane here with you until 5 a.m. David Hammond, riding shotgun. He is the dining and drinking editor for New City, contributor to the Tribune. And we're going to talk, and hopefully we'll be able to connect with Greg in Rwanda a little bit later on in the program. But I thought this would be an opportunity for those people, you know, that want to get out, maybe have a little bit of an international flair, but also experience some things off the beaten path and maybe outside of the typical kind of team photo of tourism is Mexico. And you've spent a ton of time in Mexico, certainly on the food side. I mean, it's a great cuisine and I think beloved and kind of familiar in a way.
It is.
Here. And we got a chance last night talking with our mutual buddy, Lou Bank. He's down. He called in live from Oaxaca.
Uh-huh.
And he is in good spirits, no pun intended, on the mezcal side. But let's talk about some of your journeys to Mexico and things people can do.
Well, I was in Mexico in the spring, Mexico City in the springtime, a place I am very fond of. And I was investigating the supernatural as evidenced in Mexico City. There's a couple of instances.
In the traditional sense, like ghosts and things?
More like skeletons and spirits. Specifically, I'll give you a couple of examples. I went to a witch's market. It's Mercado de Sonora. And they sell a lot of things there, but there's also...
Like witch supplies? You know, like an army surplus store? Right?
No, not surplus. This is all new stuff. You can buy...
brooms.
Potions, okay. Different types of wood you can burn to conjure spirits.
Really?
You can have your soul cleansed by a chicken. I kid you not.
Now, is this a celebrity chicken? Because remember, you know, El Peco, the famous fighting chicken, right?
It's pretty expensive, though, I've heard. Although for a reduced price, and I'm not making this up, you could have your soul cleansed with an egg. They kind of wave the egg around your face and across and say some things, boom!
Is the egg somehow genetically connected to that magic chicken?
The chicken. yes. Definitely it.
So wait a minute. Is this, you know, on the whole cleansing of the soul with the chicken? I think that's pretty great. Number one, that there's that service available. I think that's a lot of us.
Who
maybe,
doesn't need a soul cleansing now and then?
Is it something that maybe that this chicken, you know, just like, you know, like the potato chip that has the face of Jesus in it? It's one thing, or is this something that other chickens could be trained to do?
I suppose it's like kind of like the chicken in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Which we're going to come back to throughout this telecast, broadcast. You know, so they have the chicken that can, like, what's 11 and 11 in the chicken picks? 22! You know,
like, so this chicken's doing lottery numbers.
Chickens can do a lot of amazing things aside from being eaten, or in addition to being eaten. I also went to the National Sanctuary of Santa Muerte. Santa Muerte it started as an offshoot of the Catholic Church, and then at some point the Catholic Church said, you know, we don't really want any part of this. Very popular among narco-traficantes. It's the object of worship.
You mean drug traffickers?
Yes.
Okay.
Santa Muerte is a skeleton. She's presented as a skeleton
wearing kind of like wearing a blue veil, kind of like the Virgin Mary, but also like a bridal veil.
Whoa.
And she gets things done. That's what she has a reputation for. There's a great book by this University of Virginia guy called a professor called Devoted to Death, where he goes through Santa Muerte means holy death or saint death.
Wow.
And she's big among narcos because she'll help, she'll protect them from the police, but she also is good in matters of love and vengeance. There's a poem, or an incantation, I guess you'd say, in this book, and it goes a little something like this. Oh, Santa Muerte, bring back my lover to me, and if he will not come, kill him!
Oh,
that is, I am not kidding, a prayer to Santa Muerte. So, she's a complicated personality.
So this is an actual, you mentioned it at some point.
It's a religious sect.
Kind of ties to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, it used to. I mean, it was started by a Catholic bishop.
Gotcha.
It caught on in Mexico City. There are a number of shrines around Mexico City to Santa Muerte dedicated to her. I found a driver who would take me there. I showed him the address, and he said, oh, yeah, I can take you there. We go there. We walk around the sanctuary. They had the skeleton in front, and also another one in the window dressed in the bridal veil.
Is this a painting of a skeleton?
It's a skeleton. I don't know whether it's an actual skeleton or a facsimile, but it's life size.
Wow.
And it's three-dimensional. It's material. You know, it's not just a painting. They did have paintings all around the sanctuary. All of them looked a little like, you know, album art for Megadeth or Iron Maiden or something like that.
The Grateful Dead.
Yeah, well, a little more gruesome than that. I mean, like a skeleton, you know, with a sigh, like chopping down. It was kind of grotesque. Anyway, so it was uncomfortable being there. There was like a snarling dog in a cage in the sanctuary. It was very unnerving. So we leave. I'm talking to the driver, and I'm saying, in my terrible Spanish, you know, that was really incredible experience. Have you ever seen something like that? He showed me his key fob for his car. He had a replica of Santa Muerte, and he said he'd been a devotee for years, 10 years. His family disowned him because he had followed Santa Muerte. And he's she's a popular, I'd say a folk religion or a folk faith.
Well, you think about this, the connections that may be, you know, Chicago. So this is the deity that gets things done, right? You know,
it's like Chicago, the city that works.
The city that works. So I think that some people may be able to. Now, what you're describing to me, and this is from a 10,000-foot view, is it viewed as a, like there, obviously, it's a little bit different. Because the way you're describing it seems like, well, geez, maybe it'd be thought of as a cult. You mentioned
I think that's a fair description.
Or is it, you know, kind of fringy and maybe a little eccentric, but still kind of accepted? If you met somebody and they said they were part of this, you wouldn't think, you know, it's the Manson family. They would be.
Right. No. In fact, they follow many of the teachings of the Bible. I asked my driver, you know, in what ways is it different from the Roman Catholic Church? I mean, you follow the Bible, the same rules. And he said, well, in the cult of Santa Muerte, we don't have the abuse. Now, that's what he's saying. But that, you know, I don't know whether that's true or not. But I think to your point, it's a folk religion. People put faith in this semi-divine, supernatural character. And they have many endearing names for her, like they call her La Flacita, the skinny one, or La Hermosita, the pretty little one, or it's an odd kind of mixture of affection and fear that they have for her. And those who believe in her believe that she will get things done for them. They'll help succeed in business, get them the loves of their life, take revenge on their enemies.
I mean, when you need things, let's just—it's like a full 360 on the kind of things that you can ask your religion to help you with. It isn't always about, you know, the normal, like, hey, I'd like to be a better person. Maybe you ask for some, you know, some support or possessions,
world peace,
you know, maybe some good fortune. Right? This is like, hey, I need somebody taken out.
Right?
That's what you do. I wanted to ask you this, and this is when you think of Mexico, and oftentimes it gets we just recently did, I think, to Riviera Maya. We did a White Sox like vacation there, and it's all inclusive, wonderful beaches, a lot of the things that Mexico is known for. You mentioned Mexico City, and this is a city, if you could describe it a little bit, you said it's a fascinating and it's a wonderful city. It's enormous, right? As far as the amount of the population,
it is.
Plus it is nowhere near, you know, beaches, right? It's in the middle of the country. So describe like what that experience is and what you get out of it outside of a scare from
Santa Muerte,
the skinny one.
La Flacita. Yeah, most people will not find their way to the sanctuary of Santa Muerte. What I like most about Mexico City is that I like the colonial past that's represented there. The Aztec past, you know, it wasn't that long ago. They didn't know where the ancient city of Tenochtitlan, the city of the Aztecs, was. They knew it was somewhere around Mexico City, but it wasn't until they were digging right in front of the cathedral in Mexico City. They were digging electrical wiring for, I think, an underground subway system. That they discovered the ancient pyramids of the Aztecs. They were right there, and they're still finding stuff in those pyramids because they were built in structures. There were like a little pyramid was built, then one on top of that, and one on top of that, and one on top of that. Till there were like seven different layers of pyramids, and they buried precious objects in there. So they're finding caches of gold and so on there all the time, which is, I mean, yes, gold is a precious commodity, but the archaeological value of that stuff is immense. Last summer, just outside the cathedral, a cathedral, incidentally, that was constructed out of the stones from the old Aztec temple that was torn down.
Wow.
They used it to construct this Roman Catholic church. They found, right next to the foundation of the Catholic church, a skull rack. This was like a rack that the Aztecs would construct, and they would have sacrificial victims. This is kind of the more lurid, sensational part of Aztec culture.
This event calls for skull number 16, you know.
It would just be a scary thing, kind of like Santa Muerte. They'd construct this rack of skulls as a demonstration of Aztec power. And they found one of these racks, interestingly enough, mostly women and children skulls. Why? I think it's because those were the most precious things. I mean, you don't give your god, you know, the sickly old goat. You give the god your most valued object, the people you love. Women and children. Also warriors. I mean, warriors were a common object to sacrifice among the Aztec. They would go to war, not kill people in the wars, take them prisoner so that they could be sacrificed.
Yikes.
I know. Wild.
And when it comes to Mexico City and the food, so we've got a minute or so, is, you know, it's, you've got to figure that there's a great food situation going
there. I just found something very interesting right outside the witch's market, a guajolote, which is a bun with a tamale in it. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because in Chicago, we thought we had this unique food called the mother-in-law, which is a tamale in a bun. But they've been eating it in Mexico City for a long time, and it just kind of makes sense. I mean, you want cheap food, inexpensive food, set you up for a day of work. You have this tamale, corn meal, maybe a little meat in there, in a bun, more carbohydrates, covered in sauce, tasty. It had huge lines in front. It's breakfast.
We're going to get kind of some of the insight into the adventures of David Hammond, whether it's Mexico adventures, whether it's some of the archaeology that he has been a part of helping discover and certainly share, not only for there, but also on the in Scotland as well. You know, you think about Scotland for Great Scots, certainly there, the golf and the origins of that, if you're a sports fan, and some amazing landscapes, right, as well. Maybe not the greatest weather.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, so we've got that. We're going to touch on all of those things when we come back. We are going to have, after the news, we're going to get a chance. I think we're going to talk with Amr. He is the managing director for Abercrombie & Kent in Cairo. And so we're going to be transporting ourselves out to Egypt to talk about that as a travel destination. WGN. It is Dane here, high atop Chicago in the Allstate Skyline Studio. And for our show, in for Nick DiGilio until 5 a.m. today, we are taking a world tour, not only on the travel side and transformative travel, and talking about some amazing places to get out and go, and maybe not only have a vacation, but also get out there and see, and maybe potentially relocate to, and also kind of going deep into the food side in some of these places as well. And I know we're going to have the managing director for Abercrombie and Kent in Cairo, Amr Bader. He is going to be joining us. He had already called in, and we let him take a little bit of break so we didn't have to sit through a lot of the commercials. So we'll have him on in just a second. And Dave Hammond in studio as well, hey, who is the drinking and dining editor for New City and an avid kind of globetrotter. And this is a place that you've been as well, Egypt. It is a place that everybody knows, whether it's the whether it's, you know, the documentaries that you see, whether it's the King Tut stuff, whether it's the history books or any of those things. And it is a place I think we all want to go at some point. it sounds and feels like it's very far. And it's one of those places that I think you have to have your ducks lined up before you head over there.
Yeah, you probably want to go with a tour. It's and I think that's true of Africa, too, Rwanda at least. When it's a country where it's likely you do not speak the language, whether that's Arabic or Rwandan, it's good to have a guide who can talk their way through ordering dinner. At least getting a hotel room and so on. And that, so I think that I usually try to avoid organized tours, quite honestly. I'd rather set it up myself. Like Mexico City, I just go there myself all the time. That's not much of a challenge, even if you don't speak Spanish very well. But, yeah, for places like Egypt and Rwanda, I would go with an organized group. Egypt. Yep. Egypt, a fascinating place for so many reasons. Now, however, I think some travelers have questions about the safety of going to Egypt. And I went there right after the Arab Spring and right before the Islamic Brotherhood was voted into power and then overthrown. So I was there like in what might have been the last really peaceful period. And even then, tourism was way down. We'd go like to the pyramids. Everyone goes to the pyramids. They had a huge like government set up these like concrete vendors' stalls. They were just about all empty. I mean, they had taken a huge hit then. I can only imagine what it's like now.
I think it makes it more important than ever that you have to have, I think, adequate, experienced guidance to be able to, because it's undeniable the history and the amazing experience that it can be to be able to see and experience Egypt in person, whether it's, you know, so many of the different things in Cairo, one of those great cities in the world, and, of course, the pyramids and all that history. And Abercrombie and Kent, and this is one of those groups, and they have offices all around the world, are able to be that kind of that guide, to be able to allow you to experience it in the absolute best and most enriching way possible. And we have Amr Bader. He is the managing director in Cairo, calling us all the way from Egypt. Amr, welcome to WGN.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning from Cairo here. It's about 11 o'clock here on Friday, so it's our national day off. So good morning to all of you and the listeners.
Thanks for coming in.
Appreciate you being able to take a little bit of time to share with the listeners. WGN Radio here, we reach 38 states in Canada at night, and it is nighttime here, so hopefully a lot of people around the country are hearing about it. So for the people that kind of know, they think about Egypt, they hear it, they see the pictures, they know what it is. From your perspective, what are the things that people don't necessarily know that are amazing experiences that they'll get when they go?
Actually, quite plenty, because the beauty of Egypt, we think of it as actually multiple destinations. If you if you've been to Egypt, you will, or even if you've not, if you just studied about Egypt, you will know that we have so much to offer. So between, of course, the most classic way to do it, which is to come and see the pyramids in Cairo, Giza, and then go down the Nile to Luxor and Aswan, that's considered like one whole era, one whole destination, and actually most popular in the Western world for people to come and visit the Great Pyramid and cruise the Nile and go to Abu Simbel and visit the tombs in the West Bank in Luxor, or visit the land of Nubia in Aswan, or the Cairo Museum, or potentially the Grand Egyptian Museum, which is about to open in 2020, which would be probably the largest museum in the history of mankind. So that's a whole destination. This is like a 10-day trip. And then you have, on the other side, the Red Sea. So when you start going to the Red Sea, you go to places like the Sinai Peninsula, you climb up the Mount of Moses in St. Catherine, you snorkel, you dive. Some of the best snorkeling and diving places in the world are in on the Red Sea. And then you have places in the Western Desert, so you go to Siwa, and you camp in the desert, and you safari, and you go in the sand dunes, and you go in the mineral water. It's just breathtaking kind of experience if you're looking for real adventure, raw, natural, untouched. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful part of the country on the western side. Or if you want to go into Greco-Roman era, so you start to do Alexandria, and you visit the oldest library in the world, the Library of Alexandria, the Greco-Roman Theater, the Jewelry Museum, so much to offer. You have multiple layers of history. Yesterday, actually, I was invited to go and visit the Abdeen Palace. The Abdeen Palace is where Egypt was ruled during the royalties up until the 1952. And then later on, when we had the revolution of 1962, the Egyptian leadership continued to use the palace as the office of ruling the country. At some point, the presidents did not actually physically rule from there, but they continue to have offices to date from this palace. So this palace is actually, I would think, even better than Versailles.
Wow.
I mean, just breathtaking. Yeah, I mean, you see so many amazing things there. So you have that whole, you know, that whole Ottoman, royal, Egypt era, that you see just some amazing wonders between the Muhammad Ali Palace in Manio, between the Jewelry Museum in Alexandria, the different eras, you know, that were left from that time, to then going to the museum of the Islamic Museum in Cairo, or if you want to look into the Byzantine area, or if you want to look into mummies. So there's just so much to do. There's also amazing shopping. Some of it is very contemporary, some of it is very traditional, but it just exhibits an amazing, amazing style and art that you can only see in Egypt.
Amir?
You know, that's so beautiful, is Egypt, actually. Yes?
Excuse me, Amir. You had mentioned something there that I wasn't familiar with. I'm a major museum fan, and I try to go to the major museum in every city. You had mentioned a new one, Grand Egyptian Museum, was it?
Yes. What I'm glad I was able to provoke that question.
Yeah, could you tell
us? Grand Egyptian Museum. Sure. This is a project that began in 2009 or 10, if I'm not mistaken. It was basically a grant by the Japanese government, about $2 billion, maybe a little bit more. And the government back then was actually struggling with having so many pieces at the Egyptian Museum in downtown, in the center.
Uh-huh.
And you probably know about that museum. So the Cairo Egyptian Museum had so much stuff that could not even be housed or exhibited because of space and size. And, of course, that museum is a masterpiece. It's a gorgeous piece for any, you know, full museum in the world. However, because Egypt is so antiquity rich, it just could not continue to house all what they have. Plus, of course, the number of tourists was increasing day by day, year by year. So the government had to think out of the box. It's a great idea. So to move the Grand Egyptian Museum nearby the pyramid. So when the tourists come to Cairo, they can do all of the major sites in one area in one day. So you have the great pyramids of Giza, you have Saqqara, you have the pyramids of Dahshur, and you have the Grand Egyptian Museum.
Wow.
So that's really something that's quite unique.
Mm-hmm.
So they began the work. Then the work was interrupted by what you called Arab Spring, which we don't call Arab Spring because we don't believe it was any spring. It was nothing but a black autumn, but thank God we got rid of all of that. So that was 2011. So everything was slowed down because of that Arab nightmare that began in 2011. Thank God it kind of all went behind our back, and you know, now stability is back on track and things are really moving forward very well. So the work has been completed in as much as they could. Obviously, it's just a huge finance. It's a big project. It's a massive, massive, massive museum. I think it's maybe twice the size of the Louvre, or maybe three times the size of the Louvre.
Wow.
And they're using the latest technology, and they're also trying to transfer the pieces. There was a huge celebration last year, I believe, about moving one of the pieces. So a few years back, they moved the statues of Ramses, and that took maybe, I think, a week or more to just transfer one piece, because, of course, they have to make sure that everything is intact and so on and so forth. So work continue there. So that museum is going to open in 2020. However, here is the good news, and that's for your listener. Right now, if you wanted us to arrange for you to have a private preview to the gym, we call it the gym, the Grand Egyptian Museum, we could do that. We could do that. So you could basically send to the Department of Antiquities a request. It typically gets approved in less than 24 hours, and you could be going there to visit for a fee. So this is something that the Department of Antiquities has made available for visitors of Egypt to basically write their name on the history and be part of seeing that museum before it's open. There's also a possibility that you could make a cartouche with your own name and they place it there on some of the sort of wall of honors and so on and so forth. So that's a big, big project.
There's also
a new airport.
Hold on, Amr. I just wanted to stop you for a second. So amazing stuff that go far beyond just the visiting of, let's say, the pyramids or some of the things that we see. And you brought it up as far as the new museum and amazing ways to get involved with that. And certainly the contemporary, the shopping, the sightseeing, the snorkeling, things that you don't necessarily at first blush associate with Egypt. We've got just a 2-minute break to take, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the importance of Abercrombie and Kent and having people that are able to help shape some of those experiences so that you can get the most of what it is that you do. Yeah, that you can have access in ways that maybe you wouldn't have if you just tried to do it on your own, and how people can get involved and enjoy Egypt along with you. So stay there, Amr. We'll be right back with you in 1 second. Got to take a quick break. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, high atop Chicago, Allstate Skyline Studios. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. Dave Hammond. To my left, you know him as the dining and drinking editor for New City and also contributed to our very own great Chicago Tribune. And on the line with us calling as we take our world tour of travel and for the taste buds, we've got Amr Bader. He's the managing director in Cairo for Abercrombie and Kent. So Amr, welcome back. And I think when you go to a place that you've wanted to go, and we've had a number of texts come in where people have said, you know, everyone would love to go to Egypt, but you want to do it in the right way and you want to feel as safe as possible, number one, and then also that you're going to get a little bit of that guidance, right, from people in the know that are on the ground there all day, every day, to be able to help shape that best experience.
Absolutely. Well, safety, of course, is the most important thing, and that's no issue at all in this whole country of Egypt today. It's been really wonderful in the last 2-3 years. So as far as really the guided tours, there are places where you could do things on your own. Here you could, but it's just a little different because here there's just so much to learn and see about. And so when you go to the pyramids and you have a great Egyptologist that can bring that history in half an hour capsule to you, it just makes a whole difference. When you don't have to queue to get equipment, because it's a busy country, it's a busy destination, it makes a big difference. When you go on the Nile and you have someone that explains you the history of the Nile, when you, you know, go to the Islamic Museum, when you want to go to the shopping areas, to visit the sites of Coptic or Jewish or Islamic Cairo, that just all needs somebody to kind of bring that history alive. And that's the beauty about a guided tour in Egypt. But again, it's just so much to do. The variety is just unlimited here, whether it's about the destination itself, because it goes from historic to classic to adventure to extreme adventure to different types of activities, diving, etc., climbing, to all types of things, to also the different geographic areas. So to be on the Nile, you could be, you know, in the desert, you could be doing this, you could be doing that. So just a lot. And the history itself is quite rich between Pharaonic, Islamic, Coptic, Jewish, just name it. We have it all here. Everything has kind of started here. So it's an old civilization. It's maybe one of the oldest civilizations in the world, 7,000 years or more. So that kind of richness needs someone to guide you to get the best out of it in whatever time you have available to visit it. So that's the beauty of Egypt. Now, on that note, you know, we have actually my dear friend and the world-renowned archaeologist, Dr. Zahi Hawass, who I could maybe bring on this interview quickly if we have a minute to get him online. Would you like that?
Yeah,
absolutely. Wouldn't that be a great surprise?
That would be amazing. That would be amazing, Amr.
The Indiana Jones of the world. Hold on a second. Let me get him online.
Okay, sounds good. So here's one of the things that this is for those people that get an opportunity to see some of the documentaries, and we talked with Blake about whether it's movies that inspire people and a lot of the documentaries that inspire people to get involved and interested in some of these locations. And Dr. Hawass is like, if you've ever seen a documentary about Egypt, about the pyramids, the, you know, King Tut's tomb or any of those kind of things, you know, he's the guy. And he was the Minister of Antiquities for Egypt for a long time. And now, as you can imagine, is one of the faces of the country. And
Dr. Hawass on the phone with us. Isn't that a great surprise from Chicago and WGN?
It's amazing, Amr. And Dr. Hawass,
there we go.
Welcome to WGN, welcome to Chicago, but
thank
also
so
38 states in Canada hear you. We've got a huge signal, so the greater portion of America is hearing you on the radio with us tonight.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to talk to you.
So, and I know that we were talking with Amr about the history, and it's undeniable, so many things. But also, I think, David, you had mentioned that there is a more recent discovery. They're still discovering things, right, David?
Dr. Hawass, I'd be interested in hearing you talk to the new tomb that was found in the Valley of the Kings in Luxor just very recently. And I know that tombs...
I'm excavating now in the Valley of the Kings. You know, the Valley of the Kings is divided to the East Valley, where the tomb of Tutankhamun, and the West Valley. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. We can hear you great.
Yes, sir.
And the West Valley, where is the tomb of Amenhotep III. Actually, I made for the last few months some major discoveries, but I did not open a tomb yet. But I'm in the process of opening a tomb soon in the Valley of the Kings. And what I want to say, there is no tombs found in the Valley of the Kings, but there's some discovery happened on the private cemetery at an area called Tira Abu Naga on the west bank of Luxor. Some disturbed tombs of some officials are dated to Dynasty 18, about 3,000 years ago. But the most important recent discovery, in my opinion, that I believe it is the best discovery of the year 2018, is the tomb that's found at Saqqara. I entered this tomb during the discovery. It is dated back to 4,300 years ago. It has more than 30 statues carved in the solid rock. Mm. And the owner of this tomb was a priest in the time of Dynasty 5.
Amazing.
Oh, so talk a little bit about, as you have...
But, you know, I always say that we found until now 30% only of our monuments, and it's still there 70% is buried underneath the ground.
And is that the thing that brings most people over there? Obviously, the work that you've done, and you've done such an amazing job presenting so much of what it is that we know, you know, on television and the history of Egypt and a lot of the things. And I know there's a lot of other things to see, but as far as when people come over there, isn't really that you can't go to Egypt without seeing
the pyramids,
and the tombs, right?
But I really think that, you know, we suffered a lot for the last few years, because of that, people all over the world think that there is no security in Egypt. But I want to tell you, I can guarantee every American to say one word: Egypt is safe. And therefore, I think because of the discoveries that happened in 2018 and the announcement really encouraged people. I was really
talking and writing about the meeting of our president yesterday of tourist groups at the pyramids. That was also an important message to tell the people that Egypt is safe. The pyramids, mummies, King Tut, Tutankhamun, are amazing tools that capture the hearts of people all over the world.
Dr. Zahi Hawass, thanks so much for getting on and sharing not only some of the exciting things that are happening, like you said, so much more to discover, but also that Egypt is a safe place for us to get out there and experience an adventure. And a big thanks, Amr, as well. So,
yes, Amr,
we're going to go ahead and put a link up at WGNradio.com, not only with this interview, but also for Abercrombie and Kent, for ways that people can experience and have a little bit of that guidance to make sure that they're getting the full effect of what it is that they do from their travel. So, guys, thanks so much for jumping on the line, especially on your day off. We appreciate it.
Shukran.
Thanks for jumping on the show today. And we have a great rest of your weekend. Perfect. And happy
have
New
a great
Year.
Day.
All right. Thanks. Wow.
Thank you. Happy year to you also.
All right. Wow. Okay. So Amr Bader, you know, from Cairo, managing director for Abercrombie & Kent, and Zahi Hawass, the leading, basically, the you know, as far as the tombs and all of those things, basically like the face of Egypt on the, I don't say the promotional side, but certainly on the scientific side. So excited to have him on. Excited for our listeners here at WGN. Okay, so when we come back, I think we're going to have
Kate Webster.
Kate Webster's going to be joining us from Down Under as our tour for travel and the Taste Buds continues. We've had some pretty good songs. 720 WGN, high atop Chicago Allstate Skyline Studio. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. alongside on this tour. We really do have to have our globe out. We've got our maps all unfolded, and we're spinning the... Do people even use globes anymore, David?
I doubt it. I have one. But
here's this kind of probably some collector's item globe.
Has the Soviet Union on there still. So
yeah, that voice that you hear is Dave Hammond. He is the dining and drinking editor for New City and, of course, contributed to our very own and great Chicago Tribune. And you heard the music, you know, it's Men at Work. That was one of my favorite songs way back in the day in the land down under. And it's the kind of place that we feel basically because of the music and Crocodile Dundee and a bunch of other things. We feel, I think, a connection and a familiarity with Australia. But there's a ton that we just have absolutely no idea. Sure. You think the Opera House, right, in Sydney. You think koalas, right? You know, I'm trying to think
Kangaroos.
Emus.
Witchetty grubs.
And a witchetty grub if you're looking for a snack, and we'll certainly cover the food side a little bit. And on the line with us, a person who is there and has her hand on the pulse of so much of it, from Captured Travels, the one and only Kate Webster. Kate, welcome to WGN.
Hello, how are you? Hi, Kate.
So we've got Dave Hammond, who you know. He is in studio with us as well. And so when it comes to kind of sharing and carrying the torch for Australia, what are some things about Australia that people don't necessarily know from either movies or TV or some of the pop culture things we've seen?
I think you all know about Crocodile Dundee. That's a given. And recently Tourism Australia put out that wonderful ad pretending that we were going to do another Crocodile Dundee, which unfortunately I hate to say is not really the case. But look, you know what? Australia is a place of many, many different things. Like you just recently mentioned, yes, the beaches, yes, the Opera House, Sydney. We're known for our barbecues, the Harbour Bridge, seafood, Kakadu as rock, you name it. Like, there's so much to explore down here.
And wine, too. Barossa Valley wine is fantastic.
Oh, look, not just the Barossa Valley. We've actually got quite a few wine areas. So we've got Margaret River across in Western Australia that is famous for wine, also the surfing. But we've got the Hunter Valley in New South Wales. And also down near Barossa is also McLaren Vale. That's also quite famous for its wine. So, yeah, the wine is a big thing down here.
You have... on the travel side of it, you know, certainly sharing a lot of the destinations that people, there's so many beautiful pictures and so many things that people can see. But I think Australia, one of the things that people need to keep in mind is just how diverse it is yeah. from the experiences that you can have, whether it's like a Great Barrier Reef situation, whether it's a modern, you know, urban situation in Sydney, or whether you're out, like on the outback. Are there, if you had to pick one, and people listening right now, if they had to pick one Australian vacation to do, is it possible to do
one part of Australia?
Yeah, is it possible
Western,
to do
Southern,
four or five, or do you kind of got to pick one and maybe go back several times?
Oh, that's like saying pick your favorite child. It's impossible. Australia is so big and diverse. No, but look, Australia is so big and diverse. And like for me, I'm a beach girl. I live at the Gold Coast, just about an hour south of Brisbane. So I live on probably the best beaches in the world. We've got the best surfing. We've got the best like laid back. And when you think of Australians, you think about that laid back culture. You know, summertime, you're out in the backyard having barbecues, you're playing beach cricket. So for me, the ocean is probably my highlight. So you mentioned the Great Barrier Reef. Yes, get out on the ocean. You can sail, you can kayak, get under the water and do some diving and snorkeling. That to me is the best of Australia. But that's, once again, from where I live, I'm a beach person, so I'm on the beach and I'm used to that. But you go out bush and you go out back and you've got a completely different experience. So you're seeing things like Ayers Rock. You're seeing the outback, the true red centre of this country. So I honestly couldn't pick. I could not pick a favourite spot.
How about a favourite food? Something, and that's usually my focus, something that is popular in Australia that maybe Americans have never heard of. I'm thinking of things like pie floaters, which I love the name of. And I don't honestly know if Australians eat many pie floaters, but I did when I was there. Are there any other foods like that?
Sounds like something from a water treatment plant, David, honestly.
But it's delicious. It's a meat pie floating in pea soup is how that works.
It has been a while since I've had a pie floater, I must admit. But if I was going to say anything, and look, listen, with Christmas just happening,
yeah.
One thing that we are famous for is our barbecues.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, everything goes on the barbecue. And we're famous for, obviously, the shrimp on the barbecue. We actually call it prawns because shrimps are small to us. Mm-hmm. So we'll chuck seafood on the barbecue. We'll chuck a nice, big, juicy steak on the barbecue. Everything down to your vegetables, even. We'll put pumpkin. We'll put potato. Everything, even dessert. We'll do barbecued banana.
Now,
pineapple, you name it.
Kate, can you... now, when I was in Australia, and I was only in southern Australia... we had kangaroo a few times, and it was a novelty. Can you put kangaroo meat on the Barbie? And I ask because it's very lean meat, or do you have to treat it some way, like marinate it or pound it or make it suitable for barbecuing over direct flame?
Look, kangaroo meat is such a delicacy. It is probably the highest protein meat you can get. Mm. There's no fat. It has to be cooked really slow, though. So you want it to be rare. You want it to be tender. So, yes, you can put kangaroo on the barbecue if you wish, but you have to make sure you turn that maybe twice and take it straight off.
Mm-hmm.
Slice it up, put it in a salad, and it is just delightful.
Mm-hmm. What would we always use that phrase, it tastes like chicken? If you had to describe something that people may be more familiar with that has kind of a similar flavor profile, what would you say?
Crocodile.
Okay.
Crocodile tastes like chicken. But no, like your kangaroo does taste like beef. It's
beef,
just a little bit more gamier. Yeah. Definitely beef.
It's red
but
beef.
But it's a little bit more gamier. Yes, yes. Very strong tasting. So you really, really do need to cook it rare. Otherwise, it goes very tough.
Another little question on the food side. And, of course, Dan Long in the booth playing some of our bumper music as our lead-ins, and you had Men at Work. And, of course, the Vegemite and sandwich is mentioned in there, too. Is this something that have you had one of those? Do you eat, like, what would it be? And is it something that we can maybe kind of dabble in or make here in Chicago?
Look, Vegemite on toast with a lot of butter in the morning is the best. It's high in vitamin B, and it will just give you a boost for the day. So I've grown up as a child. We used to have Vegemite and cheese sandwiches at school. But Vegemite on toast in the morning, you can't beat it. It's the best.
Kate, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've had Vegemite before, and I think a mistake people might make when preparing a Vegemite sandwich is laying it on too thick. I mean, I think of Vegemite more as a condiment, something you kind of spread like butter, even on bread. You don't put a lot of it.
It needs to be very light. No, very lightly spread.
Right.
Definitely.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Unless you feel like you need that extra vitamin B. No, very, very lightly spread. Otherwise, it's too intense.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to Australia and we mentioned a little bit during the lead-in is that we feel that connection, whether it's some of our favorite television personalities or hit shows or just the common language or just a general kind of a festive attitude.
Former British colony.
Yeah, I mean, we feel like we know the people, and throughout the course of this program, we've done a little bit of exploration and adventure to places that maybe don't share that same kind of connection. I mean, David was talking about visiting the narco trafficker church in Mexico City. Sounds like a dangerous place. But Kate, as a person there, living there, and knowing that connection and how the people of Australia feel about the people of America, is it mutual? Is everybody, I mean, do they really support and appreciate, Americans and just either whether it's our culture, way of life, or pop culture, things like that?
Oh, look, absolutely. The good thing about Australia is we have such a strong multiculturalism here. So we welcome in anybody from any country, any culture, because that's what builds us. Like, I know that I can walk down the street and I can taste different foods from different countries because that's what people have brought to us. And it's like something that's instilled with us. I don't know when we're born, maybe, but we love to travel. We love to explore and we love to meet different people. And one thing you'll find about Australians is we're everywhere in the world. And we're very laid back, and we will, accept anybody, and we are happy to sit and chat over a beer with absolutely anybody. Like, that's, I think, one of the greatest things about where I live and what we do is, we're very welcoming of anybody.
Kate, is there much of a craft beer movement in Australia? That is, in the United States, it's huge. Everyone's making beer. Some people making it at home.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that's happening in Australia as
David,
well.
I'll have to stop you before that. We know that it's just Foster's. Foster's is Australia. That's the only thing that they sell there.
Australian for beer,
you know what? Foster's in Australia is actually found in the import fridge. It is the weirdest thing. But if you go to the local, bottle shop, which we like to call the Bottle-O because we shorten everything, but Foster's is found in the import fridge. Nobody here drinks it. Nobody. But, which makes me laugh. But yes, the beer in Australia just goes hand in hand. So craft beers and microbreweries have popped up all around the country. And even to the point where I live at the Gold Coast, we have some local surfers, like our world-famous Mick Fanning, Joel Parkinson, Bea Durbridge, Josh Kerr. They've actually started their own brewery to make beer called Bolter Beer. So it is beer, local beers are popping up everywhere. And it's great. You can go to the pub and there are so many different flavoured beers you can try. It's crazy.
Anybody making banana beer?
No, not at the moment. Not at the moment. I wanted to bring some back from Rwanda, but unfortunately Australian customs and biosecurity, they're pretty strict on what we can bring into the country.
Well, we're going to mention that, too. And think about this. So we're going to take a break, and we come back and talk and let the listeners know, talking with Kate Webster from Captured Travel. She's calling us from Australia, and she does so much to kind of share some of the adventures that you can have in Australia, whether it's any part of the country. And certainly on the cuisine side as well, but it does not completely and 100% define her. So when we come back, you're going to talk about some of your efforts in Rwanda, some of the things that you're working on, and sharing a little bit of that as well. So hold tight, Kate. We're going to get right back to you. It's Dane here, along with Dave Hammond, 720 WGN. WGN, it is Dane here with you. Allstate Skyline Studio until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio. And we've got David Hammond from New City, the dining and drinking editor and contributor to the Chicago Tribune, along with us as well. And on the line with us on our kind of world tour for transformative travel and certainly for the taste buds is the one and only Kate Webster from Captured Travel. Kate, welcome back.
Thank you.
And I know that you wanted to, and a little bit later on in the program, maybe in about 10 minutes, we're going to have Greg on from Red Rocks from Rwanda as well. And he's got a little insight into the banana beer. I know that David is super excited about that. But let's talk a little bit. I know you wanted to share some of your thoughts on Rwanda, some of the efforts and things that you've got going on.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I was spent some time in Rwanda just recently and with Dave. And we went out and we did the gorilla trekking in Rwanda, and that probably is what drove me into such a passion for conservation travel, because we were sat there looking at these mountain gorillas and they're so endangered, and we had the most magical 1 hour with these incredible animals, and it made me come back and think, well, look, what can I do to show the rest of this world what these animals are? And it's not just the gorillas in South Africa has the rhinos, Tonga has the whales, like Borneo has the orangutans. There's so many places in this world with some amazing animals that we kind of need to get out there and see and understand to know how we can better conserve them.
Yeah, actually, I have a piece coming up in Make It Better magazine about that gorilla trekking episode, Kate.
That sounds like an awesome magazine, David. Make it better. There's nothing wrong with that.
And I think the whole, you know, conservation effort with the gorillas is making a better world.
Absolutely.
I mean, this sounds corny as hell, but I actually feel like more in tune with nature having been banged into by a gorilla.
Yes. And how true is that? Is unless you see these animals and understand them and spend time with them, I think we can't really relate to them. Like, yes, it's one thing to see them on documentaries and read about them in books and magazines, but when you're actually sat there with them, how incredible was that, David? Like, it was amazing.
I'll never look at a gorilla in the zoo the same way. I mean, and I think that's... And actually, I think it's going to be kind of sad to see him in the zoo, which I haven't since I got back. But
well, I think the thought process of having zoos exist so that you can see them in as best a natural habitat as you can create in an urban setting allows you to understand that they are real and right. And I think it inspires people. But what you guys got a chance to do is so far above and beyond, because you see them in their habitat. And it's the kind of thing, and a lot of the stuff that we do, Dave, you and I on the food side, certainly radio and the travel, and a lot of it is because it's interesting, it's fun and exciting, it's enriching on a personal basis. But I want you to talk a little bit about it, Kate, if you can, is, you know, you get into kind of sharing some of these experiences on the travel side, and it's certainly wonderful to share and inspire people to get out and come and visit places. But there's almost a real higher purpose when you feel like the work that you do on the sharing the experience side and on the promotion of the travel side that can change, you know, their lives and just keep these beautiful animals alive, change cultures, right? Just change maybe even government mindsets to kind of build them into the tourism side that you're really making. I mean, unlike what you can maybe do just on the promotional side of marketing and travel, but you're making a huge difference.
You know, Kate,
absolutely. And
I'm sorry, we hadn't talked about Quita Itzina yet. Would you care to comment on that? It was a naming ceremony for baby gorillas.
Yes. So it was a naming ceremony that was actually originally established by the Rwandan people. So they would name their children. And it's something that they've passed on now to the gorillas. And once a year, they have this ceremony called Kwidazina, where they will name baby gorillas that were born during that year. And it's a great platform to, like, launch that conservation and just say, look, hey, we are doing good things out here. And these gorillas are actually, they're having babies. They're growing in numbers. And that's the one thing that you want to see with animals like this that are endangered. It's seeing their numbers grow. And Rwanda is a perfect example of that. Look, they've got their conservation right. They're doing it right where you do go out and you spend time with these gorillas, but it's very controlled because they don't want you to impact too much on the lives of these gorillas, but they want to give you a sense of, look, you can go home and you can experience this and tell everyone else, like, this is what I've experienced and this is why it's so important to make sure that we do everything possible to ensure that these animals will survive.
Is it the kind of thing, you know, when you get a chance to see that stuff and they're looking to kind of engage you as a writer, as an ambassador on the travel side, do they help shape saying, here's kind of what we need? Or is it left up to you to kind of say, hey, I understand that the tourism works. If we can make the value of these beautiful animals be to visit them and see them and not necessarily, you know, in their body parts and what they can be sold for, is there kind of a meshed effort where they say, let's work together, Kate and David? Or is it the kind of thing where you just have to figure it out on your own and say, this would be something great I can do?
I think just getting us out there, like writers like me and David, or any tourist, to be quite honest, because word of mouth is just as strong. So I think that it's important just to get people out there and see, and just see what's happening and see these animals. Because one of the biggest things with conservation is you don't know how to help unless you know it's there. And if you can see them and you know it's there, then you know to go home and talk about it. And you talk about it, it might just be like your average Joe going out and doing a gorilla trek. He will go home and say to his friends, look, I had this amazing experience. Like, let's think twice about how we do things in our world. And I think that word of mouth is more important. And as writers, yes, we get to go out there and we get to put it on a bigger platform, but everybody can make a difference.
If we're captured travel, you get out there and you get to do some fun things and share some great experiences and inspire people to take sort of dream vacations. But talk a little bit about the inspiration for it, why you started it, and what some of the things that you do and how people can get involved and see all of the things that you do, not just necessarily just these couple different scenarios we're sharing today, but all the stuff you're doing with Captured.
Yeah, look, Capture Travel is just a platform for launching what I have done. So I've actually gone a bit more so into conservation travel, which has kind of come about in the past couple of years. So probably it came in last year when I was in South Africa, and I got an opportunity to go out and spend some time with an anti-poaching unit in Madigwe Game Reserve. And we went out and spent some time tagging rhinos and notching them and putting microchips in their horns, because obviously rhinos are completely in a place where they're so endangered. It's vital that we get that message out there that these animals, if we don't look after them now, they're not going to be around for our future generations to see. So that was the launching pad for me. The moment I sat with an African rhino as he was being microchipped, it really hit home to me that these are animals that we all need to do something to help conserve. And from there, it's gone on to the time that I spent in Rwanda with the gorillas. And I actually went straight from Rwanda and to Tonga and swam with some humpback whales in Tonga. And the same thing, like the whaling in the world at the moment, like it's is a point where if we don't do something about this, we might not see whales in our waters. So it's kind of snowballed from that. And so I've actually launched these tours with Where Wild Things Roam Travel. So people can actually come and experience this wildlife, but they're actually getting some really hands-on conservation activities that no other tour company offers. So we're working with local companies that are on the ground. You've got these people that will be with you from start to finish and explain why it is so important to do this work with these animals. And like one of my babies is South Africa. I've always been a fan of South Africa. So the rhino conservation there for me has been an absolute like high point. And one thing I am like pushing as much as I can. So look, these tours are, it's giving you an insight into the wildlife. It's giving you insight to what's happening that might be destroying that wildlife. And it's giving you an opportunity to give back and be involved with something that you can take back home and say, well, let's make a difference. Because at the end of the day, everybody can make a difference. If we all just do that little bit, it will make a big, big effort. A lot less.
Helping to shape amazing and unforgettable once-in-a-lifetime type experiences, but with a higher purpose built in that I think benefits everybody, including the planet and all the creatures and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. As we let you go, give the either your social media or the website where people get more information and get in on some of this with you.
Absolutely. The website is www.wherewildthingsroamtravel.com. Jump on it. You can learn a lot about just conservation with wildlife worldwide. We have a great little Facebook page where everyone's getting involved. We've got some amazing tours that are happening in next year. So jump on. If you've got any questions, do shoot us an email and I can answer those. And we would love to see you on one of these tours so you can go back home and tell everyone about it and we can do something that's going to make a difference.
We'll have a link up at WGNradio.com. Bless you, Kate, for everything.
Thank you, Kate. Good talking
you're doing.
To you.
Thanks for jumping on the show tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
WGN WGN high atop Chicago Allstate Skyline Studio. Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio. And just as he often, he'll talk movies, he'll talk great lists, he'll talk things that you'd want to do coming up in 2019. I'm sure we'll get to some of that as well in some shows, maybe a little bit later on today and maybe certainly as shows coming up. But transformative travel is one of the things that on our show On the Road that we do Saturdays at 2 p.m. is we'll often talk about ways that travel can kind of change you and shape you and certainly entertain you. And it's great for families. And it's really one of those kind of, I don't know if there's another thing out there experience wise that can really change the way that you either feel about a certain thing or a culture or the way that you can appreciate it. It's really something special, Dave. I mean, you've been a proponent and a participant in travel for your whole life.
And we were talking earlier when we were discussing Santa Muerte, how you don't pray to Santa Muerte for world peace. I do think, however, that travel is a way to encourage good relations between people. I'm not going to say that it'll contribute to world peace. That's kind of highfalutin. But you do, when you live in another culture, even for a week or so, you come to understand those people in a way that you can't just watching them on television or hearing about, reading about them in a book. Going to a foreign country almost always transforms you a little bit. You start seeing the world in a slightly different way. You learn new words. You learn new ways of doing things. You learn new ways of eating.
Here's one.
Most importantly,
as some of these places become kind of more of the either hot place, whether, you know, something, maybe Anthony Bourdain goes there and so people are like, hey, let's head over to this place or that place. I know he's done some things on the Philippines. It's not necessarily thought of as a big tourist destination. A good portion of my family has a background so that we're always, you know, it's in the conversation. One of the things, and we had a caller, and you can too, 312-981-7200, you know, people are kind of sharing some of the places that they have thought of that they want to go, that they may consider kind of relocating cool. to. And Iceland, you said cool, It's called Iceland, and it's one of the places that's been one of those hot destinations, and someone had mentioned, have you been to Iceland?
I
know a few people that have.
Tell you about, talking about weird food earlier, they eat some things in Iceland that would set you back a notch or two. Example, rotten shark. It's called rotten shark. I mean, it's in Iceland.
Is it called rotten shark?
It is. Well, it's called.
Or is it aged artisan shark?
Well, it is aged underground. It is literally buried for a while so that the bacteria in the shark meat kind of digests the meat somewhat. And then it's sold in small little portions, and it's referred to as cheese shark because it smells a little like Roquefort. I'm not kidding you. That was my first stop when landing in Reykjavik, was going to this market where I knew they had hakarl, this cheese shark, and it was only that one day of the week. So I went and bought some. It was wild. Also, they like to eat pony.
Little
miniature ponies. Whoa. They keep them as pets.
Are you serious?
They eat them. Yeah. I mean, you can see it on menus. It's called foal. I mean, that means small horse, F-O-A-L.
Wow.
Now, Icelandic. It's a terrain like I've never seen anywhere else in the world. I would love to go there again. Not cheap. Not cheap. In fact, it was one of the more expensive places I've been. But it's the only place to get cheese shark or pony.
Rotten shark or My Little Pony. I mean, I can't even believe it. You think that... Okay. So some of these things that maybe jump out for someone who's out there, you know, kind of looking for something interesting or something that catches your eye or the thought process. And but it may not be something that everybody, you know, enjoys. It's, you know, we mentioned the Philippines, the balut, you know, and I remember talking with Andrew Zimmern about it a little bit. It's out there and they consider it, and I'm doing the air quotes, it's a delicacy. But most people are repulsed by it, as they should.
Yes, it's a fertilized duck egg.
Right, yeah, it's a duck egg, and it's kind of in that, and you enjoy it.
Oh, yeah, it's a fully formed little bird with wings and everything, and you can eat the whole thing.
Well, we're visiting, talking a little bit about the food side of things, but then also talking a little bit about the, you know, animals, you know, that are indigenous to certain areas of the world. And you got an opportunity, we've talked about it a little bit, to visit Rwanda and spend a little bit of time with Greg Bakunzi over there at Red Rocks Rwanda, and we finally were able to get him on the line all the way from Rwanda. Greg, welcome to WGN.
Thank you.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, Greg. Yeah, I'm here.
All right.
So let's talk a little bit about what it is that you do. Obviously, you're providing a great opportunity for people to come visit with you, experience a little bit of the culture, and do it in a way that not only is exciting, but also fun, and we'll put the website up as well. But you're doing a lot of things out there. You know, you're helping out the town, the culture, in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, I'm doing a bunch of stuff here. As you might have seen from Red Rocks, we are doing a bunch of stuff, giving experience. And the whole idea we have is to see how can we bring community, conservation, and tourism together for sustainable development in this part of the world.
Hey, Greg, as you know, I'm a fan of your banana beer, and I'm not sure if I told you yet, but I spoke with the boys at Pipeworks in Chicago. It's a brewery, and this spring, early summer, they're going to try to reproduce your banana beer in Chicago. There are a few things they're not going to be able to do, because I do believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you're preparing the bananas to be made into banana beer, you bury them in the ground for a while so they kind of ripen up.
Yes, we do bury the bananas. We get them when they are still, like, green. Mm-hmm. And after that, we bury them in the ground for a week. When they get yellow, we take them out. After taking them out, we smash them in a mixed up with some grass that we get from along the swamp. And those grass, after smashing them together, we get the juice from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With that kind of, after getting the juice, we get the sorghum and then fry the sorghum. After frying the sorghum, we put the sorghum inside the juice and keep it for 2 days. After 2 days, we take out then it formulates itself. Then after that, it makes a banana beer, and that's the one that you go to taste when you were visiting us.
I enjoy. I was telling Dane it was the best banana beer I had in Rwanda. I mean, just way, way ahead.
Even he thinks that's... Now, Greg, of course, you are, when it comes to the brewing the banana beer, you're a brewing pioneer, right? And we can appreciate that. We have a lot of craft breweries here. But also, we're talking about the areas, and we've heard about the wildlife and some of the experiences. But food-wise, give a little snapshot. Outside of the banana beer, which I think is an important staple, what are things that people love and enjoy eating when it comes to Rwanda?
Yeah, the first thing they really do, like the food, I have to say, being also located around the volcanic rocks, which erupted back in 1847, and with all these, our food, anything that you grow up, anything that you can put on top of those volcanic rocks comes up. So that means their food doesn't need any kind of fertilizer. Any chemicals is not needed. So we have a bunch of different food. I have to say, even our location, leave alone from international people who come to visit us, but our area is the food basket of Rwanda. That's where 99% of all the best food comes from. And the reason why we have such a the best food, they range from sweet potatoes. We have got the cassava. We have got peanuts. We have got yellow bananas, and we grow a bunch of really different, we have yam. So we grow a bunch of different food around this area of ours.
Also great coffee. We bought some amazingly wonderful coffee in Rwanda because it's on volcanic soil and it's equatorial. I mean, it's hot, it's moist, and it's got incredibly fertile soil. The coffee was wonderful.
Yeah, we do grow coffee, we grow tea as well, mm-hmm. and we have got a lot of sugarcane as well around. And I have to tell you, all these things, they don't need any, we don't put any organic stuff, any chemicals inside. So they're just grown because of our soil, which is more fertile. So that's where we grow, and that's why you find that our coffee smells good. We have got the best coffee anyway.
Well, let the listeners know we're talking with Greg Bakunzi. He is there, the driving and visionary force behind Red Rocks Rwanda. And so describe, you know, the experience that people will have, because I've seen on the site, so you're not staying in a big hotel. You're staying, it looks like in tents or cabins right there, you know, out in the countryside, and you really get to experience Rwanda firsthand.
Yeah, the most part of the experience that we really like to give the people that get to visit us is like we organize all these cabins, we organize all the tents, so you can come with your tent, you can stay in our tents. We have got like a kind of like a hostel, we have got a boot camp where we invite like students from different university schools who would wish to come like to do like maybe a research on culture, on community tourism development. We do get people also who come to do like research on primates. So they all get that kind of experience of overnight, let's say, in a homestay. And they get to taste the real local food, even participating in like, helping out like preparing that local food is also a part of another experience that we give to our guests. Apart also from that, we have got a botanical garden where it has got all different types of different local herbs that most of the people here use. They use all these local herbs to treat themselves. They think, oh, why should I go to the hospital or to the clinic to get some tablets? I should use some local traditional herbs. And then we try also to show people something like that.
So you learn a little bit about the culture, some traditions, some of the medicinal side, as well as the food. And, of course, you get to interact with some of the animals and the wildlife. So Greg, describe how it works. Is this the kind of thing that people that are listening can come and just hang out anytime? Or is there a part of, like, set programs that, you know, maybe it's a week or 2 weeks at a time or longer? How does it work?
It all depends. Let's say, for example, I would say for people who want to understand the real, to do a kind of like a research, they would take like 4 to 6 weeks. For those people who just want to have like experience, coming here for like a week to 2 weeks would really be great to get into this and get to understand how is the cultural tourism benefiting the local community around here, at the same time enjoying it, the experience, like the way how then even did that when he was here. You know, the first when he grabbed the 5 liters of the banana beer, everybody in his group was like, hey, then what are you doing? What's that? You know, where did you get this? So it was a very great experience than having something which is more packed in a factory, or this is made locally, you know. Yep. So it's local made stuff, and it has, like, you know, we can say that it's like 99% local.
So much to see in Rwanda, so much to experience at Red Rocks Rwanda. We'll definitely have a link up at WGN Radio for that. Maybe not the least of which is the inspirational leader behind the banana beer brewing movement, right? And so, so Greg, we'll have some stuff up, but give the information as far as either social media where people can do that or websites that people can follow. Like I said, we'll have links too, but go ahead and share that before we let you go.
Okay, all right. As you might have seen in brief, we have like Radio Southern Social Enterprise, and then we have got a non-profit organization which is behind the Red Rocks, which is there to develop all these kind of initiatives that we are coming up with. If you want to check out like the non-profit organization website, you have to go to www.redrocksinitiative.org.
RedRocksInitiative.org, and like I said, we'll try to put as many links up as we can, and stay in touch, Greg. Happy New
Great
Year
talking to you, Greg.
With everything, and thank you so much for everything that you're doing on the conservation side, and certainly helping to shape great experiences for people all around the world, and thanks for jumping on the show tonight.
All right, thank you, too.
Take it easy,
all
friend.
Right, Greg McKenzie, the man behind the banana beer. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to hear about a place where they have things a little stronger than beer, right? Scotland. And Dave Hammond's going to share his adventure there, so keep it here on the road. Well, it's actually not on the road. It's just staying here, 720 WGN. 720 WGN All-State Showcase. Well, Skyline Studio high atop Chicago, and Dave Hammond in. You know him as the dining and drinking editor for New City, hey, Chicago Jay. Tribune, and oftentimes as one of our favorite food writers, drool-worthy is probably something that you you hold alongside of high praise, right?
Drool-worthy? I'm drooling all the time.
If you're doing it right. So, okay. So here's the thing. We've teased this a little bit, and now we're going to have that opportunity to talk about your adventure to Scotland. It is the kind of place, if you are a golfer, people dream of going to, you know, St. Sure. Andrews and being able to do that.
Where it was invented. Yep.
If you're, you know, a fan of Scotch and the origins.
Definitely.
Obviously you want to go to a place like that. Talk about Scotland in general, because, you know, in my mind, I think of those couple great things. And then I think of, you know, landscape. I think of, Braveheart. You know, you think of haggis, right? You think of things that maybe are not quite
which
as
gets an incredibly bad rap, I think. Haggis does.
Well, let's hear about it.
Well, as some of you may know, haggis is made from, it's like a sheep's stomach stuffed with lights, they call it, which is like esophagus and lungs of the lamb, which is why you can't make it correctly in the United States, because there's no USDA standard for esophagus and lungs.
For sheep.
So they don't.
Is this a great esophagus?
This is a standard for sheep. Anyway, so we were at at the guests of Glenlivet, and we went to this place and had haggis one night. And
did they tell you what it was? Or
did tell us what it was.
What did they say? What do you think? Do you like it? Was it like one of those commercials for, you know, the latest Burger King offering where you're like, hey, it's haggis?
Well, you know what? It has a bad rep, perhaps because it's made so crudely at times. This was kind of like, if I may say so, kind of haute cuisine haggis. And it was fantastic. And it was... It had some great sauce on it. They had us pour Glenlivet over the top of it.
Oh, okay.
They call it sauce. They call it sauce. Now, I learned a lot about how to drink whiskey and how to think of Scotch whiskey when I was in Scotland. For instance, we were at the Glenlivet Distillery, and this guy, Tristan Campbell, who was kind of, he's a brand ambassador, he's kind of leading the tour. Now, Glenlivet is one of the very first single malt whiskeys to make a big splash in the United States. And I'm quoting Campbell here. He says, anyone who says a single malt is a better scotch than a blended scotch is talking rubbish. Which is like, what? Because this is coming from a guy who, you know, makes his living on a single malt scotch.
From the purest mountaintop and, you know, the blasphemy, right?
They're going to be selling a lot of single malt for many years to come. He doesn't have to worry about that market. And actually, the market for high premium scotch is going up, at least according to the Distilled Spirits Council, who who sponsored this trip. Campbell's point was that when you're getting a single malt, you're getting, you know, right out, you're getting unadulterated, undoctored scotch. When you're buying a blend, this is an artistically composed scotch with scotches from a lot of different areas to create the a peak flavor profile. There's something to be said for single malt, of course. It's maybe it's kind of like having a single vintage wine or coffee from a specific region. It's got a lot of character, but it may not be the best character. His point there was that when you blend, you can engineer a taste that's going to be more likely to please. And that's a point.
I think that thought process, you know, makes a lot of sense, right? It's either you can blindly just go in and whatever happens, happens. And typically because you're from that area and using, kind of this recipe, this is what's going to be there. But if you're going to put some thought into it and have experts in the field with the goal of creating something that is more pleasing to the palate, mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. you're probably going to have something. You know, and it reminds me a little bit of on the bourbon side where, you know, Angel's Envy and Wes Henderson is a guy that I know and is a friend, and they got a lot of flack. It is, you know, acclaimed on the flavor side, but there were some purists that said, hey, what you're doing with the, you know, with the barrels and, you know, and the aging and all that kind of stuff. I don't want to say it's cheating, but it was kind of like, well, hey, wait a minute. But there's no denying that it tastes great, you know.
Something else, speaking of transformative travel, something else I learned in Scotland. First place we went to, Ardbeg on the island of Islay, right off the west coast of Scotland.
Is it always cloudy? Because I've never seen a sunny picture.
Oh,
there.
God, it was beautiful. I mean, people were always saying, oh, it's never like this. It was a beautifully sunny day. In fact, we spent two beautifully sunny days when we were there. Nice. Did it get a little cloudy? Yeah, now and again, but it was basically nice. But I think, you know, it's far north, so it's going to get cloudy now and again. Anyway, we're at Ardbeg, which makes a heavily peated scotch. That is, it's got a lot of peat flavor because they use the heat from the peat to stop the germination process in the little grains of barley so that there's maximum sugar content in there. They grind it, add water, ferment it, distill it. You got whiskey. They served some oysters with that, and I thought, I love oysters, and I'm thinking, there's no way these oysters are going to stand up to this heavily peated scotch, this really smoky scotch. I was amazed at how well they went together because smoked oysters are a thing, yeah. And you got that smoky flavor. Also, there's a brininess to this scotch that's made in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and there's a brininess in the oysters, which are also made in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So they went together just remarkably well, and that started me thinking, you know, next time I order oysters, I'm going to have a scotch with it. It goes well together.
And I know that the distilleries have tours, and you get to see if it is something that you're excited about, an enthusiast for, you know, to see sort of the origins of it. Is something I think that would be an amazing experience. Is it something that you would recommend? Now, you got to see it with, you know, the distillery kind of leading you along and kind of helping with some of the messaging and helping to kind of educate you on exactly what the most important points were. But if you were a tourist,
yes,
that was just an enthusiast on the Scotch side, would you recommend
they it? Have almost all the distilleries, the major distilleries, have a tour system set up. They encourage that. In fact, Macallan, which is a Scotch just about everybody has heard of. It's one of the most popular scotches in the world, higher-end scotches. They just built this new distillery that honestly looks like something from Krypton. I mean, it's so automated and well-designed to maximize the production of scotch. I asked our docent, I said, so I suppose when you put all this automation in, you're able to cut your workforce. And they said, no, actually, putting all this automation in and putting in this new facility, we've actually increased our workforce on the customer service side.
Wow.
They have more people showing visitors like us around, taking our coats, educating us about scotch, than they did before. Macallan's a great place to visit, Speyside Scotch.
We'll have some links and maybe before the end of the program, Dave, you can steer some people into where they can read more about some of your adventures on the Scottish side. But that whole culinary tourism thing, It is, as we say, I mean, it's a thing. It's an opportunity for people to get out there and experience some of the products that they know and love and experience, you know, how they're made, where they're made, and all that. In Scotland, the pictures of you in the kilt were amazing. We're going to take a break. When you think about traditionally great weather, Scotland is not on that team photo, but Aruba might be, right? And so we're going to hopefully, we're going to go to sand surf. And a little bit of sun, and we'll talk about Aruba as we hit the beach in our world kind of tasting tour and travel. So keep it here. WGN. Hi, it's Hop Chicago Allstate Skyline Studio. Dane here with you as we close in on 5 a.m. and start to close out 2018. In studio with me is the dining and drinking editor for New City Magazine and a contributor to our very own Chicago Tribune, Dave Hammond. So, Dave, we are going to get an opportunity. We've talked about places, interesting places. We've talked about dangerous places. We've talked about just general fun places. We've talked about great places to eat and imbibe. And then I think of all the places, what I think kind of fits with what I would think of as, you know, maybe not an educational vacation, but just kind of a regular kickback and relaxed vacation is when you got a chance to go to Aruba.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think Aruba is a place you go when you want to relax because it's a large beach. In fact, it's a desert island in the truest sense of the word. It's not like a richly lush island like, say, Jamaica. It's a spit of dry land in the middle of the ocean, and it's got a great culture, a Dutch culture. I mean, it was settled by the Netherlands along with Bonaire and Curaçao and St. Martin. And we found some delicious food there. Do we have Matt?
No, we're going to get Matt in just a bit. You know, hopefully we'll have Matt Bullen. He's the food and beverage director for the Aruba Hilton where you were staying. But one of the things that you had mentioned is that, you know, outside of the normal activities that you would, let's see if we want to have this person on, that you would think of. Oh, Dan, if you're going to, oh, Dan's actually talking. So what are some of the other things that you get? Because you figure you're going to get a tropical drink, you're going to get a beach. You're going to get some sun and a palm tree, but you've got more, right?
What I may have had for the first time in Aruba, and this may strike some as surprising, grouper, which I've purchased
wow.
in Florida many times, but I now realize what I was buying probably wasn't grouper in Florida because I had it in Aruba at Matt's restaurant, and it was so much more rich and delicious and dimensional in flavor. And, in fact, grouper is a highly counterfeited fish. I mean, that it's just like red snapper. People are serving what isn't grouper and calling it grouper because it can command top dollar.
No, grouper is one of those fish that I think, when you think about some of the more dangerous fish out there, you get your barracudas and your sharks, you don't think of a grouper, but they get huge.
They're frightening.
Absolutely huge, and they have bad tempers. They've just got bad personalities. And you've got, I mean, they get enormous. They get 700 pounds or something.
They look kind of like the predator. I mean, they've got this really outer space looking face, but they're delicious.
Well, that's good. I mean, not so good for them, I guess. But really, that is one of the things that you're looking for in a meal. Is that on the line with us? We do have Robert from Oakbrook. Robert, like you got a chance to go to Aruba, so give us a little thought process on your experience and I guess getting from here to there isn't as easy as you'd hope, right?
No. But if you have the chance, go. You won't be disappointed. The beautiful thing about Aruba is it doesn't matter, even in hurricane season, it's gorgeous. I don't think the island has ever gotten hit by a hurricane because of the 35 to 40 mile an hour trade winds, which is constant there. I mean, when I call back home, people are like, what's the noise? I go, that's 35 mile an hour winds constantly. It's a beautiful island. It really is. And fun. And there's some great restaurants you got to go. We went to one restaurant right by a trailer park. And people were like, no, it's the best food, bar none. I mean, outstanding. And, you know, half the price of when you get off of the beach.
What did you have? What did you like? What, a fish or?
Oh, no. They have, I had steak that was from Africa.
Hmm.
So I don't really know. All I know is, but the the only problem with Aruba is it costs you about $900 to round trip air. And it's one way from Chicago to Aruba. But to get back to Chicago, it's about an 18-hour flight.
Now, you see, that's one of the things that people don't necessarily think of. And, David, you and I went to St. Croix for the St. Croix mm-hmm. Food and Wine. And, mm-hmm. and you think of these things as Caribbean, but they really are far. I mean, St. Croix is as far from Miami to St. Croix as it is from, like, here to Miami. So you're right, Robert, right? Some of these places, they don't sound as far away as they really are.
Well, no, and it's a five-hour flight from Chicago to Aruba. But to get back, there's no direct flight back, so that's the only headache.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, but again, I took Aruba Air until they no longer existed. But Aruba Air, you land in Miami, you get on Aruba Air, booze is free, they hand you a hot towel. I mean, they take care of you. I was like, what airline is this?
No, it's not the kind of thing that you see a ton of now and then. So describe a little bit as a traveler there. Certainly it's got the sun and the surf and the sand and all that beautiful scenery. But as far as the people go, is the language and maybe the currency, is it easy to get around and do stuff?
Oh, no, absolutely easy as heck. It's unbelievable. But of course, American dollars are accepted. Yeah. Most people speak, you know, almost everybody speaks English, plus they have their own language, but everybody speaks English. And there's a lot of people from Europe that go there, because I believe it is the British Islands.
It's Dutch, yeah. But
it's Dutch. I mean the Dutch Islands. I apologize.
It's,
yeah.
Oh, cool. So it's still, yeah.
Wonderful people.
Mm-hmm. It's regular.
Wonderful people. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm stepping on your line.
No worries.
Students still go. I mean, it's usual for an Aruban student to spend a couple of years in the Netherlands as part of their education. I mean, the Dutch culture is ingrained in the civilization there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they are. It's a great place. You know, again, you know, I know a bunch of years back it got a bad rap because of some moron, but, you know, like anywhere else, if you're going out with friends and folks, go out with friends and folks and go home with those friends and folks, because booze is pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
and they will get you hammered. So
I think that's in the brochure too. So Robert, thank you so much.
Yeah, trust me. You know, you know they'll give you a gallon of booze for a buck, you know, so. You know, well, you know what I'm saying. But hey, it's a very nice place to go.
All right.
Good food, good people, and the mm-hmm. people that you meet when you go there. You know, they're from all over the world, and it's quite a lovely time.
All right. Well, thank you, Robert. I appreciate the insight. Thanks for listening, number one, and thanks for checking in and jumping on the show tonight.
Hey, no worries. And you guys have a wonderful new year out there, and everyone be safe, all right?
Thanks, man.
All right. Okay, so here, that's what you get for Aruba. So you have an opportunity to get, you know, they've got a lot of booze. That's what I've heard, right? And it's very economical. And you get to experience some of those things. Well, those are the things you kind of, you know, are looking for and want, you know, from your sort of tropical vacation. But you got a chance to do some things. We're trying to see if we can get a hold of Matt. But
yeah, Matt Boland, the chef at the Aruba Hilton, took us out to a couple of places that are a little bit off the beaten path for tourists and which I valued immensely. I mean, the first night we were there, we went to this great restaurant, fantastic fish. But it wasn't what the average guy eats in Aruba. So that's kind of what I was interested in seeing. So Matt and his wife took us to this place called Saco Philippe. And it's like Philip's sack. It's because...
I was going to say, how's it translated?
And it means like a sack of food you buy, and it's like food to go. They sell Johnny cakes, which, interestingly enough, is derived from the word journey. People would make like these journey cakes that they'd put in their pocket, and they could, you know, walk to work or keep them in their pocket at work.
Yeah, like a snack for the road.
Yeah. Journey cakes became Johnny cakes. So they make these Johnny cakes, fried chicken, all really simple stuff in this neighborhood called St. Nicholas, which is a little bit sketchy.
Anywhere near the trailer park that Robert had mentioned?
It's near the red light district. It's probably not a place a tourist would normally wander, but we were there with two locals, so we felt totally cool going
right,
there.
Right.
We also went, and this is, whenever I go to a place, I'm looking for food. I'm also looking for evidence of previous cultures that might have been there. So I'm Googling words like cave paintings, petroglyphs, ancient ruins. We found, and this is a place Matt had never been to, but he knew how to get there, this cavern covered with these drawings from the Arawak Indians who have been gone like 600 years. And there were sketches of, what was interesting was there were sketches of fish, there were sketches of animals.
Animals that didn't exist anymore? A mammoth of something?
No. But they were, sometimes it was kind of hard to tell what animal it was, but certainly like some fish, insects. No pictures of people, which I found very interesting, that the focus of their world was not so much on the society, but on the natural environment.
Or maybe there was a super hyper-intelligent race of insects and animals that were also maybe artistic.
We'll hear about it on the History Channel. Ancient insects from outer space. And this was most interesting to me. We were just talking about Scotland. I saw some images on these caves, like this circular vortex image that I saw in Scotland on these ancient Celtic drawings. I've seen it now in Aruba, Arawak Indians. I've seen it in Mexico, too. And now it could be just like a universal symbol of maybe it's the sun, but it's like a spiral. It's like a vortex.
I saw something about it was a documentary, and it was somewhere in the UK, you know, somewhere there where it was. I don't want to say an ancient civilization, but certainly people that didn't have direct access to now, right? So they had to say, like, these people created these, and a lot of that artwork was there. It was like a spiral.
Those spirals,
right?
And you see them in the American Southwest, the Anasazi. The indigenous people who used to live there, they're now referred to as ancestral Puebloan peoples. They lived in pueblos, you know, like rock houses. I'll keep going. One thing that Matt made for me that was pretty interesting was it's called Ishirena. I think I'm getting that right. Ishirena, which in the local language means stuffed cheese. Now, I've seen this same thing in the Yucatan. It's an Edam cheese, and after the cheese has been eaten out of the Edam is like a round cheese from the Netherlands. Cut it in half, they scoop out the cheese like sailors would.
Like a ricotta kind of thing, right?
Oh, well, it's a hard cheese.
Oh, gotcha.
So they scoop it out, so you have like this bowl of cheese left over. The sailors, Dutch sailors, they toss it out like, we're not going to eat this old rind of cheese. The indigenous people would find it and go, hey, this is good food. We can use this. So they would stuff it with stuff and then cook it. So and maybe turn it upside down. So you'd have like this mound of cheese melted because it was exposed to heat, but containing vegetable or meat or something saucy. And they still make it. It's called quesillena. It sounds a lot like queso relleno, which is stuffed cheese in Spanish, Mexican. Popular in the Yucatan.
I'm getting some similar themes here because also you had, Greg had called up and he buries the bananas in order to make the banana beer. Then, of course, we've got the shark. You bury the shark.
I'm trying to pull through some rotten shark themes here. Vortexes, buried food, stuffed cheese.
And I think that's it. And the possibility of alien visitors, right, that everybody's kind of making the squiggles around. I don't know. I think there's something to that. We're going to take a break, and we come back. I think we're going to revisit. We're going to see if we can get Matt on from Aruba. If we can, great. If not, we are going to go back. I still wanted to ask David a little bit more about Scotland and the kilts and some of the outfits that you've had. And then also, too, is we're going to talk about some of the places that he is just auditioning, if you will, for that next kind of residency that he's doing. So right now, we're going to take a quick break. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. WGN Allstate Skyline Studio. Dane here with you in for Nick DiGilio for another handful of minutes until 5 a.m. until we have Dave Plyer and the opening bell. And in studio with me for the duration of the program has been Dave Hammond. You know him from New City as the drinking and dining editor and contributor to the Tribune. Does a lot of travel for sure and a lot of eating along the way.
And drinking,
as you could imagine. And when it comes to drinking, I know we got a chance to talk a little bit about your trip to Scotland. I saw, and this is one of the great things that you do, is you are, and I think it's important in this day and age. It's one thing to go have the experiences, take some pictures, and write a story and have people enjoy it that way. But now, with social media, you're able to share so much more and kind of on the fly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we can kind of feel as though we're going along with you and enjoying it. Do you like that interaction?
I do, and it's also a great way for me to keep track of where I've been and what I saw, because I'll be at a place and I'll be eating a food or trying a scotch or whatever, and I'll kind of take notes on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and then I can go back to them later and verify information that I got on site. It's kind of like taking notes on my trip, only not as sloppy. I try to give people insights into what I'm doing, and those then become notes for future articles that I write.
Whether the picture is you in front of the pyramids at Giza, or bare chested somewhere in an art exhibit,
or in a kilt,
and that was, you know, Hammond. I think that is that. I don't know what your necessarily background is, but it's
not Scottish. No.
So you just happen to have this kilt, and you're like, this is the perfect time to wear it.
We went to this event with the Glenlivet people, and they provided us with kilts, which was awfully nice because they're very expensive, it turns out. I mean, you'd think, you know, it's just like got a piece of tartan wrapped around you in a vest. They go for well over $1,000, you know, for the outfit. And I've always wondered.
Are there secret pockets in there? Or, you know,
Well, I have an extra. No.
All right,
yeah.
It's a family show.
They are. Is it?
I would like it to be.
I always wondered how Scotsmen could wander around on the glens in relatively cool to cold weather in what I thought were dresses. But these kilts are heavy as any, and that's one reason why I think they're so expensive. They're really heavy. And when you're wearing these stockings that pull up to your knee with the kilt kind of overlapping there, it's really pretty warm and gives you a lot of moving around room for like climbing up stony crag faces and so on. New Year's resolutions regarding scotch. And one thing I've resolved to do this year is to always put water into my scotch. Now, I used to put ice cubes, but the folks at Glenlivet and elsewhere, I'd ask. We'd go to, you know, these different distilleries.
You'd be surprised at how much there is. You'd think like, well, geez, what's the big deal, I guess, right? But there is, you know, whether it was Robert Mondavi putting, you know, ice cubes in his wine, or whether you have here on the scotch side, there's like this group of purists out there, like the old schoolers who come out against stuff like that, right?
Well, here's what Campbell at Glenlivet told me about it. First of all, none of them thought ice was a good idea. None of them. They said, you know, just like you kind of crunch up when it's cold outside, same thing happens to scotch. It holds in the flavors when you add ice cubes. You want the flavors to be released. So they said, when they're tasting scotch in the tasting room to make sure it's tasting the way it should for their brand, they dilute it by as much as like 50%. They dilute it down to a 20% alcohol level.
Wow.
So if you have 40% alcohol or 80 proof, they're putting in half water to their scotch. That's to release the flavor. Now, that's a lot, and that's for like a technical tasting thing. If you're just drinking it at home, sometimes when you go to these tastings, they give you a little eyedropper and you're putting in drops. Right. The guy at Glenlivet, Campbell at Glenlivet, was saying, no, this isn't a science experiment. Don't do that. Be generous with the water. So he was splashing in maybe, you know, you have a glass of scotch, he was putting in maybe 25% water.
Wow.
I mean, quite a bit. And that's how I've been drinking it lately. And it really, the flavors seem to be released. So for New Year's, I'm resolving to improve myself by adding water to the scotch I drink, and not being shy about it either, adding a good healthy splash.
Okay, so that's one thing, and I think people can follow in your footsteps there. And I could see how that would work, maybe not necessarily the way that you'd want to always enjoy it, but I think it'll take a little bit of maybe the strength out of it
so that you can, right, exactly, the
burn there. So on the travel side, and as an inspiration for those people out there that want to go and see more of this great and wonderful planet, are there places that either you haven't been that you want to go to in 2019 or that you want to revisit because they're great?
This is kind of a bucket list thing. I blew my chance to do it once when I was in Patagonia, and that's to go to Antarctica. I could have, it cost like $1,000, $1,500, something like that, to fly to Antarctica from Patagonia. But I'm sorry I didn't do it because that's the one continent I haven't set foot on yet. So I'd love to do that.
So Antarctica?
See some penguins.
That's the kind of thing that you, all that trouble, and you already mentioned the expense, and
tag,
you get there.
Tag, I'm done.
And you see like,
yeah,
okay,
it's that stupid. Yeah.
Maybe get the selfie with whatever kind of, you know.
A penguin.
With a penguin.
Or a polar bear advancing behind me.
So,
right.
So that's it? That's the one place?
Well, I mean, I'd love to. I've been to parts of China, never been to Beijing. Would love to go there and say hello to our future overlords.
No, come on. We've got that next great chapter is yet to be written, you know, where we come back you know,
it's yet to be written. You're right.
Yeah. Okay. So then also too is for those people that have an opportunity to hear you here, and it's so fun to get that opportunity to share some of the stuff on the radio side and talk to some of the guests and do all of those kind of things. But also, you know, writing is the medium, right? So where can people find you? Certainly New City for sure.
New City, definitely. Tribune. Regularly. I also write for a Wednesday Journal / Oak Park Eats in Oak Park, where I focus on issues more than just Oak Park food, but just food issues in general that tickle my fancy. I'm writing about beans now. National Bean Day is coming up.
But here's the thing. So food is usually and typically in the wheelhouse. The travel is often sort of the backdrop for the food that you find yourself next to. But also you do have sort of an, you know, we got a chance to talk to Dr. Hawass from Egypt earlier today, is that you do have sort of this archaeologist mindset as well.
Yeah, I'd like to do more writing about archaeology, and I'm doing some of that for Atlas Obscura. You know that site? AtlasObscura.com. It's like it translates to like hidden world, and they focus on non-touristy things, but just odd little places that might be off the general road for people. I just wrote an article about some petroglyphs I ran across in Nayarit, Mexico. Virtually uncovered in textbooks. Spirals. Yes, there are spirals there, as there are everywhere, thanks to our insect forebears.
Do you believe that the spirals are evidence of an alien civilization that's probably, you know, responsible for Easter Island?
No. I think it's...
Or just a thing that people make circles.
Yes.
That's what they do.
I think so. I think it's something that occurs to people independently all around the world.
Independently all around the world. That is where you will find Dave Hammond. And Dave, give out the social media so people can follow you and all your adventures as you travel.
David Hammond on Facebook, DCH Hammond on Instagram.
Stay tuned. Coming up right after the news, we're going to have Paul Lisneck. He is going to be doing the opening bell for you as we get into this weekend, the last weekend of 2018. Right now, though, and thanks to everybody who listened to the show, thanks to everybody who participated in particular. Dave, thanks so much for
sitting
in.
Dave.